I'd like to call the meeting of Lasaga Heritage Council to order. Members, we have on our agenda today, the primary purpose is to adopt and recommend to the House and the Senate an appropriations bill that includes our recommendations for fiscal 2010 Outdoor Heritage Fund project recommendations. Before you, we have an agenda, the usual. We need to adopt an agenda, approve our meeting minutes from a week ago. Bill's going to talk about some things that are going on that he's been involved in, have a general legislative update, and then we will discuss the bill draft that is before you that Greg and Janelle and Bill and others from the advisor staff has helped put together. On that, I would like to have Bill, when we get to that item number five, have Bill walk us through the bill, and we'll have time for questions. Then we will take a motion to adopt and recommend that bill to the House and the Senate. We will make any changes that are needed to the bill and then hopefully adopt the bill. Following that, you can see agenda item number six is a discussion of strategy and next steps. It's fairly open-ended, but I know that several council members have contacted either myself or Bill about what's next? What do we do as a council? What do we do individually? What happens? And Rick, I think some discussion from the legislative members of this council about the process would be helpful at that point. I guess I'd entertain a motion to approve the agenda as drafted.
So moved.
Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we have an agenda. You should have the March 16th meeting minutes in your packet. Hopefully you've had a chance to go through those.
Approval.
Motion to approve the meeting minutes as drafted. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting minutes are approved. Bill, time for an update from you, just a couple of items.
At our last meeting, there was some question about the constitutionality of paying tilt out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. You'll find in your packet a letter from me in response to a request by the council to contact the Attorney General and get an Attorney General's opinion on whether or not the Constitution allows payment in lieu out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. There are actually two questions there. The second one is whether it could be used to establish a trust account, which is a slightly different question that has to do with the 25 years authorization. I have received a communication from Ms. Eller of the Attorney General's office. I asked her when we were liable to receive an opinion, and she in lawyerly form said it depends. Depends on how much research and history they have to go through. So that is that item. I also have in your packet a projected cash position sheet that I'll briefly try to explain this to you. It looks something like this. It's the last item in the packet. And in the top part of the top table, where you see 8%, $75,000, 3%, those numbers, I have attempted to model the expenditure based on my knowledge over 30 years of watching these programs to calculate the line called total monthly expenses, and then have run the total monthly expenses against the monthly receipts to provide a monthly balance and an ending balance. I've provided that information to the Department of Finance and requested that they tell us what impact borrowing would have on our interest receipts. And that's the table at the bottom, the rough estimate of the cost of borrowing from the general fund. The way it works is any month that your balance goes negative, you pay interest on the average daily balance at the rate of 1.711%. You either earn that interest to the Outdoor Heritage Fund if it doesn't go below, go negative, the balance. If the balance does go negative and we're borrowing from the general fund, that interest goes to the general fund. I ask finance to give me the worst possible case, given the cash flow situation shown in the top table. And the worst possible case is that there are no expenditures out of the fund in July and August, and all of the $6.840 million of receipts in August goes into the account. If that were the case, that gives you the highest average daily balance for the month. The other item, or the other assumption that was made, was that that 6.84 was deposited August the 20th. And if you did that in September, because you pay the interest the month after, we would pay $44,000 to the general fund to borrow to meet the $607,000 ending balance problem in July, which is the only negative balance we have across the year. Thereafter, we would earn interest on the average daily balance, and we would earn $71,000 in interest. So we would pay $44,000, earn $71,000. This is complex. The reason it's here is because in the bill, on page 11, is the authority, subdivision 8, is the authority to borrow money from the general fund if the balance goes negative.
Okay. Any questions for Bill on the spreadsheet? Dave, as our treasurer, have you had any comments? Have you had a chance to look at this?
Yeah, Bill and I have had numerous discussions about this, and what this allows us to do is avoid scheduling exactly when everyone is going to get partial or full receipt of their particular allocation to ensure that we have positive monthly balances at the end of each month. Bill's done a great job of looking at all of the proposals and figuring out when it is likely that they will draw upon the funds. There are a couple of instances where we've specified specific dates to not go negative. And Bill's talked, I believe, to the organizations about those dates, and there don't seem to be any problems there. So, you know, it won't work exactly like this, but it works pretty well, and I think the methodology is good.
And Bill, just to clarify, this is a worst-case scenario, best you could tell.
Hard to be a seer. Given the way the bill is crafted, for example, the force for the future payment is delayed until May, I believe. Late at any rate. All reimbursements going through the Department of Natural Resources are delayed until November the 1st. So there are a couple of things in there that slow the flow of money out. As long as those things stay in place, this, I think, is the worst-case scenario. I don't think we'll be paying $44,000 in interest. In fact, I know we won't. But that's the worst case.
Bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Bill, so with the numbers at the end of the line here, you're talking we're still going to net 37.
That's correct.
So we could you know, we can tell folks that we have to borrow from the general fund, but the bottom line is at the end of the day, we're going to end up making 37. Should we, and that gives us the opportunity to put the money out on a schedule like David was talking about.
Any other questions? Scott?
Well, it's not really a question about the bill, but on average, when an organization has funded a project or finished a project and they submit requests for reimbursement, how long will it take that organization to get paid?
Once the reimbursement arrives in the DNR office, if DNR staff are doing their job, it's 3 days maybe.
Okay. Thanks.
They're all on electronic funds transfer. Takes a day to look at it, a day to process it, and then it's the next day it's there.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Any other questions regarding the spreadsheet? Is there anything else?
You remind me of I'm not
drawing anything.
No, that's it.
Okay. Let's move on then to just a general time for a legislative update. We obviously met a short time ago, but is there anything from our legislative colleagues about any activities in either the House or Senate that the council should be aware of? Rick?
Thanks, Mike. We had talked last week a little bit about bonding, and there's been some activity on the bonding bill, and you may ask, why does that affect us? Well, the question of substitution is a critical question. And so there has been in the past a lot of money that's been provided to reinvest in Minnesota through the bonding bill. And we have an allocation for reinvest in Minnesota in this bill. I had introduced a bill for $5 million in bonding for reinvest in Minnesota to leverage the WRP. The way the bonding committee's process works in the House is that each of the finance committees make recommendations to the bonding committee. That was done last week, and that recommendation from the Environmental Finance Committee does include reinvest in Minnesota. So what likely happened this week is a bonding bill will be put together, and they move out of committee. At least the reinvest in Minnesota is in the arena, so to speak, in the House. There's nothing for reinvest in Minnesota in the Senate bonding bill, to my understanding, Alan.
Because DNR was in there, and it was the same language carried over from last year for all the projects that involve prairies.
So there's no new money.
So the House bill, our hope is that we will have some new money in there that then shows the state's commitment for ongoing, so we are not substituting this appropriation any dollars. That's one of the things I'll be working on this week. I did think, and in the last few days, that the WMA question could also be there, because we traditionally provided WMA dollars. And we're kind of at the point now, I don't know if there's anything we can do to correct that, because there hasn't been a WMA bill for bonding put in. But that's just something to be aware of. At least on the room side, we do have a bill in and it's in play.
Anything else on the legislative front?
Mr. Chairman, do you have anything to add?
Bob? Okay. Very good. Then let's move on to the major item of today's discussion. And as I said, we have a draft appropriations bill that incorporates the spreadsheet that we adopted last week. What I'd like to do in terms of order is to have Bill walk us through this bill and explain what's in it. Then I would like to take some questions of clarification or, short of any proposed changes to the bill, just questions from council members. Then I'd like to entertain a motion to adopt the bill and recommend it's being forwarded to the House and the Senate. And then we'll go through that, see if there are any changes. Before we do take a vote on the bill, for those of you who are out in the audience, if there's someone who wants to provide public comment on that, on the bill, which incorporates all of our recommended appropriations, we'll take public comment at that time. So with that, Bill, do you want to just take a few minutes and walk us through the bill itself?
Yes. Starting on page 1, section 1, is basically the delineation and definition section of the bill. Section 2 begins the appropriations themselves. It shows that in fiscal year 2010, we are recommending appropriation through this draft bill of $69,522,000. You'll note that's over the amount that was on the spreadsheet because of the administration and other items that were added. On page 2, subdivision 2 begins the current section of the bill. Appropriations are organized around the themes in the Constitution. So we see $1.7 million for accelerated prairie and grassland management. I want to go through this particular appropriation in a little more detail. The first sentence indicates that this is going to the Commissioner of Natural Resources and that it includes, in the definition of on public lands, includes roadsides. And then it requires that a list of proposed projects describing the types and locations of restoration and enhancement must be provided as part of the required accomplishment plan. In later additions or later appropriations, you'll see an additional sentence that asks the Commissioner of Natural Resources to approve the restorations and enhancements. That is when that particular language comes into play, when the appropriation is for work on state-owned managed land, but the work is not being done by the state, so as to ensure that the state is in agreement as to the work that's being done. The second appropriation is to the Green Corridor Legacy Program. The third appropriation on page 2 is to the Prairie Heritage Fund Acquisition and Restoration. On page 3, Accelerated Prairie Grass and Wildlife Management Area, the appropriation is $3.913 million. Below that, Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge Protection appropriation is there. You'll note that in the sentence beginning on line 3.24 is the authority for the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources to advance funds to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The advance is necessary to avoid paying federal indirect expenses. Elsewhere in the bill, we confine reimbursements direct to the project. We could not do business with the federal government, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, if we did not advance the funds to avoid the indirect cost. The last item on page 3 is Bluffland Prairie Protection Initiative. Going on to page 4, you'll find the Rum River Cedar Creek Initiative. There is a unique feature in this appropriation, specifically beginning on line 4.9 and going through line 4.13, the language provides the authority to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to determine whether or not hunting and fishing, the property needs to remain open to hunting and fishing. This was inserted to provide a third party and also to enable the closing of the property for safety reasons, for example, by law. This is, I believe, in conformance with the constitutional requirement that any closure of acquired land be done by law. That ends the prairie section. It starts the forest section. There's only one project in the forest section, and it is the Forest for the Future UPM acquisition. Then on the bottom of page 4, the wetland section begins, accelerated wildlife management area acquisition, followed by accelerated shallow lake restoration and enhancements, followed by accelerated waterfowl production area program in Minnesota. You'll note that also allows for advance of funds. Excuse me, no, it doesn't, because we are running that through Pheasants Forever, and the advance is not required. Bottom of page 5, reinvest in Minnesota Wetland Reserve Program acquisition and restoration.
Middle of page 6, shallow lake critical shoreline, the DU. On line 6.21, we begin the final section, fish game and wildlife habitat. And on line 6.22 is the beginning of the Outdoor Heritage Conservation Partners Grants Program. The Outdoor Heritage Outdoor Heritage is incorporated into the title of this one in order to distinguish it from the other conservation partner grant programs that exist. The delineation of that program goes through page 7 and halfway through page 8. We can come back after I go through the bill if you want. We can talk in more detail about that. On page 8, in the middle of the page, the aquatic management area acquisition, followed by the cold water, river, and stream restoration protection and enhancement, followed by the Dakota County habitat protection, followed by the Lake Rebecca Water Quality Improvements Project, and the Fountain Lake Fish Barrier Project. Then, on the middle of page 10 of the subdivision 6, we find the appropriations for administration and others. The first appropriation is an appropriation to the Department of Natural Resources for 2 years worth of contract management. This is the management of the pass-through contracts that we appropriate to the Commission of Natural Resources for an agreement with a non-governmental organization, a county or something like that. That's followed by an appropriation for the Legislative Coordinating Commission for 1% of the amount appropriated, and that is for administration of the council. You'll note on line 10.23 that up to $100,000 of this may be transferred to the Game and Fish Fund as reimbursement for advances to the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. This is permissive, number one, and is working in consort with the Anderson-Hansen bill. If that passes, this language isn't necessary. If that does not pass, this language repays the Department of Natural Resources for the funds that we are currently using to finance the council, which amount to $100,000 borrowed from the Game and Fish Fund. On line 1028 is a site visit exception. This allows us to travel en masse on a bus without being under the open meeting law. It doesn't allow us to meet on the bus.
Can't do that.
So duct tape on the way in.
Well, if it gets real serious, we'll record the bus ride.
Does it allow us to receive information on the bus?
Yes, it does. I think that's reasonable given the amount of time that might be spent on the bus to use it productively. Subdivision 7, availability of the appropriation. This is tied to the accomplish, I believe. It's tied to the accomplishment report plans. Simply indicates the period during which the funds are available for restorations that are available through the biennium acquisitions, and there is an additional year. Cash advances, subdivision 8. This is the subdivision that allows us to borrow from the general fund. Subdivision 9, accomplishment plans. This is the section that delineates the council's authority over the projects through accomplishment plans. Next page, 12, subdivision 10, project requirements. This is a series of requirements borrowed largely from the Legislative Commission, Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. One is planting vegetation of native ecotypes. Two is ensuring that easements are perpetual. Specify the parties. Specify the provisions. That we receive a copy of the easement, that there is a long-term stewardship plan, and that there's an ecological restoration and management plan. On page 13, line 13.19, is the requirement that new acquisitions be restored. Item 5 is a transparency item dealing with acquisitions. Item 6 is a preference for MCC for contract restoration and enhancement services done under this bill. And B is the ability to waive the transparency clause for a specific project. Subdivision 11, payment conditions and capital equipment expenditures. This indicates that, one, that these are reimbursements, and two, that that we're only reimbursing expenditures directly related to each appropriation's purpose. Page 15, purchase of recycled and recyclable materials, accessibility. Our stock items that come out of statute, in fact. Subdivision 14, land acquisition restrictions. This is borrowed largely from 116P, I believe, and guarantees that the property be not converted over the lifetime of the property, which is perpetual, and if an acquisition is converted, that there's a process for dealing with that. And also reporting requirements on page 16. On page 17 is our moral reporting requirements. On page 18 begins an amendment to the statutes, the organizing statutes for the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. The change is found on page 19, which enables the council to employ staff and contracted consultants as necessary to carry out the functions of the council, and deletes the review of the Department of Natural Resources Administration. By January 15th of 2013, in the legislative oversight, directing those items to the administration, staff, and the council in general. And that is the bill.
Thank you, Bill. Before we take a motion to adopt and start discussing amendments, if any, to this bill, I'd like to have some time for questions that council members have, questions of clarity, and we have Janelle, we have Greg, as well as Bill here, who helped greatly in drafting this. So, time for questions.
Bill, just administrative clarity. I just went through and I put all the project numbers by the names of the projects. It makes it a little easier to trace because we've got a tremendous amount of information in backing them. So it might be something you might have considered so we can track easier on the past history that's been recorded.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've looked, but I haven't seen in here, Bill, a provision that would require that any restoration work only be done on land protected by easements or in public ownership. Did I miss it, or is it not in there?
It is not in the bill. We have the accomplishment plans to address issues like that, unless you want to include it in the bill.
I would prefer to put it in, but I'm just a lone voice, and we can discuss that when we get to a menu.
Okay. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Bob, can you say that just again?
My question was whether or not the requirement that any restoration work actually be done on protected property, either with permanent conservation easements or public ownership. The question is, should it be in the accomplishment plans or should it be in the bill?
Sorry. Thank you.
Other questions? Clarity? Jim?
Yeah, I had a question on page 2 on the Green River Corridor. It says no more than 5% of this appropriation may be spent on professional services directly related to this. What does that entail?
The professional services?
Yeah.
The professional services includes the administration and other items in the project. And this is added because this is a project that has two acquisitions in it. And that's the extent of it. They're well planned. They're already named. And I just wanted to make sure that the administrative and professional services amounts were reasonable.
And on that point, Bill, for every entity that receives funding, there will be, within that accomplishment plan, a specification of how much is going to be used in each of those major categories?
Yes.
Ellen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. On page 11, I believe this is the language, lines 12 to 27, that relates to borrowing from the general fund that you went through. Is there, this language looks like it's permanent language. Why do we want to do that beyond 2010, beyond the first year? Do we anticipate any borrowing in the future?
My understanding of this language is that it's only addresses the appropriations in this bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's
what we need to. Wrong, yeah. Mr. Chair, I just want to be very clear about that. That it's just for the 2010 fiscal year. So maybe that's. I don't know if it's just. I mean, it looks. Is this statutory language? It looks like it to me. I don't know. Or is it prior language? It's just right now. So it'll go away.
It will go away, but I think it's worth being clear about what we're trying to do here. We can add a line at the beginning and specify this is for fiscal year 2010.
Only.
Yeah.
That would be, I think that's good.
Bob?
I don't agree with Senator.
Questions? I have another question on page 12. We've got these project requirements with the plan of vegetation and. And it gets pretty detailed on why isn't this going to be part of the accomplishment plan? Why is this put into the bill?
It was put into the bill simply because it was available from the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. Their approach to this issue. And it reflects our priorities and criteria.
Wait.
Bill, I have a question on page 6, 6.33. It says the funds may be advanced in meaningful sums. Is this the funds from the big pot going to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, or is this?
Yes.
Okay. So they will not get the entire amount. We'll divvy that out free.
Councilor Inger, that's correct. This is one of the features that helps us control cash flow out.
Mr. Chair, yeah. On a related question, on the next page, there's a handwritten addition here about indirect expenses of the foundation. What's that about? On line 3334.
The payment conditions don't allow indirect. This, by specificity, allows indirect for this individual appropriation.
And why do we want to do that?
Requested by the funding.
And what does indirect expenses include? You know?
We have John Logie here from the foundation. John?
My name is John Logie with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. And we have requested a payment of 6% to Manix's. And in the ordinary course, I understand that this only really allows you to get your direct expenses, and of course every organization has indirect expenses, things like the audit or human resources or, you know, legal counsel, all those kind of things. And because we are not coming to you to request a grant, we were approached by you to manage your project, so it's essentially kind of a fee for service. So we are requesting you get our full expenses, not just a portion of it.
Mr. Chair, sir, what was your last name for?
Waggy.
So, I understand that you want to get all your expenses paid, but I don't understand why anything that you're using to administer the grant, those are direct expenses, it sounds like. So why wouldn't that cover everything?
Some of them are direct expenses. We also have a difficulty in trying to sort it out because we run at any one time up to 50 separate grants programs. So because we're running all these different grants programs, you know, we're having people involved in all the different stages. And our means of accounting, we can track for a quarter-hour period, but not less. So a lot of times when we're approving grants, you know, as many as six people will, you know, sign and stuff like that for a brief period of time. It's just very confusing. So we find it very difficult to manage to just our direct costs and these things.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wadi, are we going to, I don't know if this is the right time to ask Mr. Wadi some general questions?
Yes, this would be a good time.
So, do you manage other grants using public dollars?
Absolutely. Do you mind if I give her the background material that I...
Excuse me.
You weren't at our presentation. I put together a package for the people who weren't there. But
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Bob.
The committee.
For Senator Anderson, and I think Representative Hansen, maybe one or two others, but and Representative Conklin, thank you. We had a member of Scott led his committee through a series of meetings on Sundays. We heard from Mr. Wagner a couple times, but I think this is a good time to bring everybody up to speed.
Yep. Well, did everybody go to those meetings except me?
There were a few others that did not. So okay. I just say this is not the first time. This is a good, exactly the right time to hear.
Right. So, Don, could you give us just a little brief background on the foundation? And
sure. The National Fiscal Law Foundation was created by Congress 25 years ago to be the foundation for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And over the years, we have served more and more federal agencies. And basically, we serve all the natural resource agencies of the United States government. And what we do is we try to manage grant programs for them in an efficient way and help them to reach constituencies if they have a difficult time reaching and other things like that. And so at any one time, we're managing probably as many as 50 separate grants programs, and probably half of those are for state and local government as well. In your packet that I gave you, I put together a list of the ones that I could identify. Currently we're switching computer systems, so I don't know if I've got all of them, but I think I have 18 of them listed there for different counties and municipalities, state governments, etc.
In your office, Don, just a little bit about the organization itself,
sure.
How it's structured, who you have access to as resource professionals.
Yeah, thank you. excuse me. Our foundation is based in Washington, D.C., but we have regions. The region that I'm head of is here in Fort Snelling. We get free office space from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have three people in the office. Hopefully we'll add another one pretty soon, but it's a small office. We have probably 90 people on the staff of the foundation throughout the United States, and most of our grants managers are in Washington, D.C. These are people who usually have a master's in natural resources, and they are just young people just starting out in their career, and they assist us. And, I have three of them that work for me in Washington, D.C. to manage the grants for the central region. So that's our essential structure, is that we operate through regions.
And members, just as a point of context, Scott, as the chair, you looked and the committee looked at a number of different possible entities to administer this program. Do you want to just speak as the chair of this Small Grants Program Committee about who they were and your the committee's take on each, the kind of the pros and cons of each, and why the committee is recommending the foundation?
We try to encompass as wide a swath as we could as to who could possibly manage our grants program. And we looked at several different independent foundations. We also considered the DNR as a potential grants administrator along with Bowser or SWCD. And what we came down to in the end was the folks that ran the DNR program said, well, we do really good work, but we do that primarily on public land. And Bowser came and said, you know, we do really, really good work, but we primarily do that only on private lands. And we said, are either one of you capable or confident that you could manage both aspects of that? And they both kind of just went like that, you know, kind of held their hands up. You know, they each have an area of expertise which did not match our needs. And so when Don came and made a presentation for the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, we said, do you do work on public lands? And they said, lots of it. And we said, do you do work on private lands? And they said, lots of it. And we felt that the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation was a good fit for what we needed. And one of the questions I have about, you know, a comment about direct or indirect expenses. Most of the people that came shot a figure of bones minimum 5%, but more likely about 10% of the overall appropriation would be in administration. And when the Fish and Wildlife Foundation came in at 6%, it was 5.75, and it got changed because the dollar amount of our appropriation to them changed. You know, and at 6%, they certainly came in on what I would consider the low end of that administrative scale. So as long as all the expenses, be they direct or indirect, are capped at that total, I mean, they still are, in my estimation, the most cost conservative option that we could have picked at that time. So we're looking forward to them. Relationship with the Fish and Wildlife Foundation.
Yeah. I would add to that, Scott, that there was clearly a potential conflict of interest involving both DNR and Bowser in terms of you want folks who are likely recipients of the money to be in charge of the program. And I think that concerned a number of us.
Mr. Chair, we wanted, one of the things that the Small Grants Committee wanted was we wanted science in the recommendation or science in the proposal from day one. We didn't want somebody to come up with a project and then submit it to the grants administrator that didn't have anybody look at that project before it was submitted. And if we had used, and Darby talks about conflict of interest, had any other entity been involved with that, none of their staff could have touched the project prior to its submission. So if we were going to do a restoration project on some state property, no DNR personnel would have been able to look at that without creating a conflict of interest. By using the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, we can make, as part of the application process, that you have either a wildlife area manager or an area fisheries manager or soil and water conservation district personnel approve or agree with your project prior to submission. And that was another reason we went that way, was because we wanted the availability of those professionals to evaluate those programs before they were submitted. And we think that that will streamline the small grants process so that the grant administrator isn't looking at five times the number of proposals of which they can only fund 20%. So we're hoping that by getting the science in at the beginning, that will streamline our grants process.
Well, okay, just a couple questions. Scott, you lost me just a little bit on the last part. How will these wildlife managers and others be part of the streamlining? Before the grants are submitted through the state agencies or within the foundation you're talking about expertise?
It's actually, we'll say for an example that a small sportsman's group comes up and says, we want to go over here on this piece of public land and we want to plant 5,000 of this kind of tree. Well, if that grant went to Don or to his organization, and then he said, okay, now we have to find out if that kind of a tree is acceptable. Maybe where they want to plant it, that tree won't grow. But if they go to the area wildlife manager and say, this is our project and this is what we want to do, and the area wildlife manager, who knows the area, knows the property they're talking about, says, yeah, that's a great project, or no, I wouldn't like that project on property that I manage. I'd like you to do it or consider doing it this way. At least you have consensus between the sportsman's group that's doing the work and the manager that will ultimately manage that property when it's completed. And so if they have that if they have that understanding before, I think that'll save confusion in the long run.
So, Mr. Chair, so that's if it's a nonprofit that's applying for grants. And if it's a state entity, it can also apply for grants into this program as well. So they would just use their
They use their own in-house, yep.
And so I guess a couple questions. One is for Mr. Waggy, just tell us about how you, what your staff, what their expertise is in terms of evaluating the scientific credibility of different proposals.
Well, we have, as I mentioned, a staff of about 90 people, and we have PhDs in, you know, everything from ornithology to fisheries.
Anyway, we have them all, and
I can call on somebody. Then in our local staff, we have basically wildlife management, master's degrees in wildlife management. But we have all the expertise that I think we'll need for this.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Waggy, so how would you go through the decision-making process, and how would you work with an advisory committee from the council?
I think every single grant program that we have an advisory committee. We feel most comfortable in the role as fiduciary. And so we like to go through what we would do is we would develop criteria with this council and then, you know, put out a request for proposal, sort through the proposals that come in, see which ones are just, you know, grossly don't meet that criteria and reject them, and then work with an advisory committee on the ones that are appropriate and, you know, select ones through a usually through a point setting kind of a process and identify the ones that come out on top.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Waggy, who would actually make the decision about which grants would get funded? Would it be your staff or the advisory council?
My understanding is that we would have to make that decision. But as I mentioned, we feel most comfortable in the role as a fiduciary, and we would lean heavily on an advisory committee.
And, Mr. Chair, just one more comment, and that is our question, and this is really for Scott, is I agree with you. I think 6% is a reasonable administrative percent, but the question is direct versus indirect costs. I'm just trying to make sure we're not paying the national expenses of this foundation that have nothing to do, that Minnesota taxpayers shouldn't be paying for. And so we just need to make sure there's a line set between what costs are covered and which costs are not allowed, because we need to be clear about that with public money.
Mr. Senator Anderson, I wonder if it makes sense. I agree with you, of course, and I wonder if it would make sense if we were to modify this to cap the indirect as a portion of this percentage of some kind. Mr. Waggy, I'm making this up as I'm talking here, and I don't want to put you in an awkward spot. I don't know, Senator Anderson, you've had a little more experience on this maybe than I have, so I wonder if what your thoughts are.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. I guess I need a definition of what indirect costs are. And you gave us some categories, but it's not clear to me whether those are directly attributable to the administration of the grant or not. If they're not, I'm not sure that the legislature will authorize any indirect costs. I'm not sure.
Right. Yeah, Mr. Chair, my view of indirect is almost is paying the expenses of someone who has nothing to do with what you're doing. In some respects, it's paying a piece of the salary for the you know, the president of an organization that they may not ever see any of our grants. So.
Don, can you clarify a little bit more in detail what those might be?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, this is different from the other proposals that you're looking at, because people come to you and sought a grant, which, you know, they're prepared to do a particular project. And in this case, you know, we're talking about a service which has a full range of activities. In our case, the people in D.C. do impact this grant. I mean, like, you know, some of the things that I've mentioned previously is, like, you'd like us to have an audit. Well, a direct cost would not include an audit. You know, you would like us to have a staff here. Well, our HR people in D.C. help us hire and maintain the staff that is in this office. All those kind of things are indirect costs, but they're a part of our organization. We're one entity. We can't really break off a part of it and say, we're only going to cover this and not that. It's very difficult.
Rick.
Mr. Waggy, on page 8, it has
kind of a boilerplate on Department Administration and Office of Grants Management requirements. Are you comfortable with those?
Yes.
And feel you can meet those? Okay, and then, Scott, I had a question relating to something you said about DNR staff or advisor staff. So if there is involvement with writing the grant prior to the submission of the grant, there is public dollars that would be spent on grants preparation, even with the foundation. Is that correct?
Scott?
So if you have a DNR staff that goes out and reviews the plan, is involved in writing the plan, has DNR, Commissioner of DNR, or leadership of those organizations, how does that get clocked? I mean, where's that public dollar clocked?
And that's a good question. And what we came up with is as part of our advisory or oversight to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, what we thought we would consider was that we thought it was 1% or something like that. It was 40,000. It ended up being 3%, $94,000 or whatever the figure was. And that $94,000 could be set aside for, like, I don't know what you want to call it, for use of a better term, pre-engineering. Okay, they could actually apply, an organization could say, you know, we'd max that at some figure, $300 or something. And they could apply, if the project needed some professional help to get it going, they could apply for a $300 grant or $400 grant for pre-engineering, and that's where those funds would be used to cover technical assistance as that grant was being prepared. And that would be a max of a percentage of the total amount of small grants program. And when those dollars were out, then we would either, as the advisory council, we'd either have to advise them to kick a few more dollars in there, or it would be out for the year. And that technical assistance can be a line item expense in your proposal. So if you submit a proposal for $150,000 and you say we got $10,000 or $5,000 worth of engineering costs in there, that technical advice can be a line item in your grant proposal.
Yeah,
so then administrative cost would be greater than 6% because you would have the public cost that's added into that, so aggregate would be greater than 6%. If you have local or even regional staff spending public dollars on the administration, whether it's design, pre-design, preparation.
If administration is technical advice, then it would probably fall into that category.
Yeah, Ellen.
I have a question for you, Mr. Waggy. I know the council's recommending $4 million going to the grants program. Is there, and that's $240,000, 6%, did I do my math right? So is there a minimum threshold below which you wouldn't be interested in managing this program if that were a lesser amount? Say it was a $1 million program. Would it still
so the grant was $1 million instead of $4 million?
I'm not sure. I haven't really figured out what that. You know, obviously at some point we're waiting for you to manage it, but I haven't really figured out what that would be. And of course, the larger the program, the smaller our percentage. When this council initially started talking about $6 million program, we were talking about 5% fee. I think our lowest fee that we have is we run a program for NRCS called the Conservation Innovation Grant Program, and we charge them 3%, and that's a $15 million program. But generally, the smaller the percentage, the larger the grant program.
What's the smallest grant program that you run?
I was trying to think about that. It's probably about $500,000. That would be my guess.
And I guess another question, do you charge indirect on all of your grant programs?
In general, we do. Our organization is a really unusual organization. It was established by Congress, and there's a couple of gimmicks attached to it. And probably the most significant gimmick is that we receive congressional appropriations, and we cannot use any of that money for our operating expenses. So every year, if you look at the grant list that I give you, we spend about $1 million in Minnesota, and we get no operating income off that. The way we make our money is we usually go to corporations, foundations, or, you know, state entities, whatever, and we charge them a fee. And that's why we can't do just a direct basis, is that basically we have to cover all those other expenses in some manner. So we, one of the programs that we have is the ArcelorMittal. We take federal money for the Great Lakes, and then we go find a corporation, in this case ArcelorMittal Steel, which is a large steel company which has mines in Minnesota, and we receive $700,000 a year from them to make grants with, and we charge them 20%. And they're happy to do that because we're bringing in federal money too, so the whole program is larger. For corporations, we charge 20%. Usually foundations, it's about 12%. And then with government, it's much smaller when we do things with state governments or, you know, federal governments or whatever.
Are there any other general questions? Bob?
A couple things. Mr. Becker, we have, on this particular point, we have four people to serve in an advisory capacity.
7.27.
Yeah, thank you. Any idea, can you give us a little background on how you landed on four?
Sure. That was the size of the executive committee. So I felt it was a reasonable size that would represent the council. It's less than a quorum.
I'm wondering, with regard to the indirect expenses, if we added some language that said, including indirect expenses related to this grant program, if that would create any problems for the bank.
I don't know what that, you know, related to this grant program. I'm not sure what that would really mean.
What would mean it's not going to fund other grant programs outside of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, for an example, Don, might be that you mentioned HR costs associated with hiring someone. I'm not sure that we would want to be subsidizing the cost of hiring a person to help run one of your other regional, be a participant in one of your other regional programs, for example. That an example, David?
It's just trying to get some... I mean, I anticipate there would be some issues with this, and I'm trying to find some language that would make it clear that indirect costs are related to this program in some way and nothing else. I mean, this is not like giving an organization money to spend on their restoration program for which they're in business. It's just providing support for someone to administer a specific grant program, and if they can't cover their costs, they're not going to run the program.
Wayne?
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, I think I got confused along the way because I was way back when this discussion first started upon trying to find an outside organization to administer the funds for us. Why was it that we needed to have an outside group doing this, and why we could? I'm looking at this. We're going through an advisory committee who's going to be there and making recommendations to somebody who's going to then say, okay, we're going to spend the money. Is there a reason why we can't do that in-house?
Greg, you want to respond to that? That's a great question, Wayne. We raised that question, a number of us did, right away, about why this council, as a part of the legislative branch, can't run a program. Can you help explain that?
Chairman Wayne, it has to do with the restrictions in the Constitution on your ability to run it through the administrative agency. The same entity cannot be part of the legislative branch and also be part of the administrative branch. So you can't actually operate a program through it. You need some other entity that provides that administration. You can make recommendations to that entity, but you're not able to basically provide administrative function.
How does LCCMR have theirs dispersed?
Well, Mr. Chairman, they use an agency to disperse funds. They just make recommendations to legislation.
Are there any questions about the bill? If not, I would. Bob?
I'm sorry, just to make a point. On line 14.6, this is the Minnesota Conservation Corps. When Bill walked through this, he, I'm not sure if that's purposeful or not, but he indicated that this was language to provide a preference for the MCC to do this work. And Minnesota law in contracting has sort of a definition of what preference really means, and it oftentimes includes a financial advantage or recognition. So I don't think the word preference was really what we meant when this was presented. I think this is just, as it says, to give consideration. So I just want to be sure that we're on the record that we're not supporting preference, but just simply consideration. They get an opportunity to bid.
Yep. That's what I mean. Yep. Don, response to that?
Well, no, I wanted to ask something else.
Are there any other questions? Go ahead, Don.
As long as I'm here, I wanted to ask a question. 6, 28, and 29 say matching grants are up to 400,000 to local, regional, state, and national organizations. Are organizations in Minnesota statutes, does that include state and local governments?
I would defer to Danielle or Greg.
The chairman, it's not exactly clear, but it would be our organizations.
Well,
organizations are pretty broad term.
You could just say including state and local organizations or entities, if there's any doubt.
Members, I think at this time, entertain a motion to adopt and forward this appropriations bill to the House and the Senate leadership, and then we can take any proposed changes to the bill. But we do need to get a motion on the floor recommending adoption of this bill.
I'll move the adoption of this bill.
So we have a motion by Dave to move the adoption of this bill that will be forwarded then to the House and the Senate.
Okay. Helen.
Mr. Chair, I have another question on page 16, line 9. this is kind of the my reading glasses, so I'm trying to read it. These procedures, this is about what happens if someone wants to transfer the land or sell the land that we've invested in. And it says one of the criteria to look at in approving replacement land, I believe, is that it has a reasonably equivalent usefulness compared to the interest being replaced. And I just didn't like that term, usefulness. What the heck does that mean? Useful for what?
And Mr. Chair,
for habitat? I think we need a more conservation-oriented definition there.
Chair, Senator Anderson, you and I are tracking exactly right. That was one of my changes. Okay. What I had suggested, and Greg has, this is the middle one on the sheet that I gave you, Greg. What I had suggested is we change usefulness to useful and add conservation purpose.
So could you just restate with line numbers, Bob? So,
yeah. So on 16.7 through 16.10, it would read 2. The interest is in a reasonably equivalent location and has a reasonably equivalent useful conservation purpose compared to the interest being replaced. Does that get you excited?
That's fine. That's
I agree with
that.
That's
a lot. Thank you.
So is that a motion then? Because we do have a bill in front of us and we're proposed language changes. All right, we have a motion to adopt that language. Bill, do you want to read it back one more time?
On line 16.9, strike usefulness, insert useful conservation purpose.
Any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Sorry to be... you know, the bad jokester that I am so early in the morning. I just wanted to say to Bob, if only we had known how much we agree when you were working for the governor.
You have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I think I knew.
I'm
and
sure
still know how much we agree.
I'm sure you
Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion to adopt. Okay, David.
I'd like to propose somewhere, and I don't care particularly where, related to a project requirement, that we put in a paragraph that says all restorations must be done on lands with permanent conservation easements or owned by public agencies.
Greg, I've been informed that you have some language to that.
Mr. Chairman, David, I think it would be on page 14 if you look at, I think the easiest way to set this in would be on 14.5 before and insert a new number 6, provide that all restoration enhancement projects are on land permanently protected by public ownership or easement, and then make the existing 6 there, clause 7.
Could you read that back again?
Provide that all restoration and enhancement projects are on land permanently protected by public ownership or easement.
How about public ownership or permanent conservation easement? I don't want the government to have to own the easement. You know what I'm saying?
Mr. Chairman, David, I'm not sure that that's what it says. It's public. You could say by easement or public ownership to, if you wanted to be clear that it's not.
Yeah, we don't want to exclude if there's a Ducks Unlimited easement that you can't do the restoration on.
Mr. Chairman, then, the best way would be just to reverse those terms so there's no, so it's clear that the public doesn't apply to the easement. So it would be by easement, because it says permanently protected, so permanently protected by easement or public ownership.
Can we say conservation easement?
Chairman, you can.
Can we read that again? So, Greg, you want to try and restate that again? I know Bill is writing and is a number of us, but you could restate that.
Sure. Provide that all restoration and enhancement projects are on land permanently protected by conservation easement or public ownership.
We'll need a motion to that effect.
David? I'm moving.
Okay. Any discussion on that proposed change? Everyone clear where that is? Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Adopted. Further discussions? Adopt.
Chair, I've got try and go through this, but if I could, I have a handful of things, if you don't mind.
Please.
So I'm just going to, I wrote up a couple of these, I gave these to Greg. And I'll start with what's not on the sheet and try and walk through those if I can. On page 7, line 10, the language reads, must include amount of habitat restored. I'm going to suggest that we have restored, comma, enhanced, comma, and or protected. So I think we limited there just to restoration. I think we probably want to add the others.
So is everyone, that's line 7.10.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I think you can do that. I just think that we're going to have to look at separating the other major pieces into more clauses with semicolons rather than. I mean, it's going to take a little reworking, but I think that's fine. And we it wouldn't be and or, it would just be or.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to make that motion to change this with the suggestions that Greg had made.
So, Bill,
do
you want to just read that back? Well, you've got it, Ken.
On line 710, it should read, must include amount of habitat restored, comma, enhanced, or protected.
Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair, on line 7.27, we have the word recommendation. And I'd like to ask the council to consider that we change that to advisory. Send them any advisory panel rather than recommendation panel.
That makes sense.
So I'd like to make that motion.
Okay, so we have a motion to change on line 7.27, delete the word recommendation, insert the word advisory. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Bob?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, can I just ask a question going back to your First Amendment about the amount of habitat restored, enhanced, or protected? We have some criteria here that in some cases could be in conflict with each other, you know, could lead to different results. For example, urgency versus amount of amount, I assume, means just the biggest piece possible. You know, so that puts a premium on quantity, whereas urgency might put a premium on quality that is could be lost. And those aren't necessarily going to occur in the same, on the same piece of land. So how, I just want to be clear what the intent of this language is, that these are different factors to look at, but not every piece of land will satisfy everyone to the same extent. Do people agree with that reading of the language? I just want to...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I think it's a relative issue, and it's a weighting factor, I suppose. And if you, for example, urgency might have a higher weight, even though the amount of property is, let's say, smaller compared to, you know, another alternative. So I think I certainly read it that way, as having it washed in.
Yes.
Bob. Let's see. Mr. Chair, on the sheet that I handed out, page 12, lines 17 through 21, I have suggested language change, and again, I gave this to Greg just before as our meeting had started, so I don't know if he had any suggestions to it, but the way I read the existing language, it made it sound as if you got any funds, you had to plant vegetation, and I just wanted to make it clear that if you had funds and it was in your accomplishment plan, that you plant vegetation or sow seed that is of native ecotypes. So I tried to make this a little more clear. So I make that motion, Mr. Chair.
So the motion is to insert the words or sow seed on line 12.17 after the word vegetation.
And then at the end of on line 21?
Yes.
After possible, change the semicolon to a comma and add, if the planting of vegetation or sowing of seed is a component of the accomplishment plan, period.
Or semicolon.
Excuse me. Thank you. Semicolon.
That is a motion.
That is my motion.
All right. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
And Mr. Chair, on page 17, as I was reading, this deals with the issue of transference of property that has been acquired or some restrictions placed on it using LASARD funds. And what I didn't see in here was a requirement that the person who is receiving the property certifies that they understand what they're getting into. It's the issue of offer and acceptance. What I understood was we had good offer language, but I didn't have an acceptance component to it. So I'm suggesting that we add the language on the sheet that I've handed out, and it would read, add after line 29, add a number 4. The entity receiving the transfer of property must certify to the LASARD Outdoor Heritage Council acceptance of all manner of obligations and responsibilities held by the prior owner.
Great. But the only issue here is kind of where it's placed. It's placed under what the basically duties of the recipient of the appropriation, and this is not the recipient of the appropriation. I think it would better fit under the next paragraph. If I just modify this slightly, it'd be 17.31 before is, insert, colon, number 1, parens, and then page 17, line 32, before the period, insert number 2, and then delete the from your amendment the entity receiving the transfer of property, and then just say, so we just read the number 2 must certify to the LASARD Outdoor Heritage Council acceptance of all manner of obligation and responsibility held by the prior owner. So it would be in that sentence that deals with the person who's now responsible.
My only question is, we're around 25 years. What happens after that? Would there be LASARD Outdoor Heritage Council or successor?
Greg? Mr. Chairman, that that certainly is a possibility, because I'm assuming the legislature will have to make some allowance in the statutes and laws based on whatever.
The legislature is a successor of no one else. A friendly amendment to add or successor.
And this would be on
what lines?
I see council showing up on 17 through 6.
Yeah, it's all over.
My friendly amendment would be in Bob's number 4, wherever we decide to place it, that it be the entity receiving the transfer of property must certify to the Lazard Outdoor Heritage Council or successor acceptance of all manner of obligations and responsibilities.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're going to want to do that in other places here, too. Within this section, there are a lot of different things that are related to the Outdoor Heritage Council, and you may want to see or its successor.
I'll withdraw my motion and make a separate one.
Okay. Wow. Mr. Chair, so I make the motion as Greg has outlined.
Any discussion on this motion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. David.
So I would move that we, wherever we're referring to the Lazard Outdoor Heritage Council related to longer-term obligations and responsibilities, that we add a or successor.
Maybe, Mr. Chair,
yes,
maybe we should say successor as provided by law or something like that.
Just sure. Okay. So this is a permissive amendment, then, that where we would leave it up to staff to insert that
in where appropriate.
Any discussion on that motion? That again, where appropriate, the term or successor as provided by law would be inserted following the Outdoor Heritage Council reference. Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Rick, there's a question for Bill on lines 14.9 through 14.11. If you could maybe go through that and the rationale behind it.
Bill?
Yes, this allows waiver of the transparency language, and my understanding of the rationale for that is in the event the donation situation, if made public, would cause a deal to fall through, the council would have the ability to review the situation and waive the requirement. For example, an heir to a family farm might consider donating part of the value of that family farm in the deal and not want that to be public. So the council could hear testimony on that and wait.
Mr. Chair, I know most of this was taken right from the LCCMR statute, but I'm not sure if this sentence was as well.
Yes.
Greg, that's
true. Yep. Mr. Chairman, it is the same rider that was included last year in the LCCMR appropriation. It also is contained in this year's LCCMR appropriation vote.
So it could be used to maybe shield a contract or a need or the agreement?
Could be used to shield the agreement.
Further amendments to the bill as amended. Dave?
I just wonder if we want to go back to on page 7, dealing with this grant administration and indirect expenses, because I know there will be sensitivity to this. But we ought to add that for indirect expenses related to this grant program.
So we have a motion to add on line 7.34 after the word expenses related to this grant program. Discussion on the motion. Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Other changes. David?
I have just a question that I meant to ask. On page 10, Bill, with contract management, you had mentioned the $175,000 was a two-year allocation. It's the only two-year allocation, but it doesn't specifically say it in here as a two-year allocation.
That should be added.
So I would move that $175,000 in fiscal year 2010 is to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for contract management in fiscal year 2010 and 11 for all duties assigned in this section.
So we have a motion to insert the word in fiscal year 2010 and 11 after the word management on line 10.15. Any further discussion on that motion? Ellen.
Mr. Chair, let me just, if I may, I maybe missed the first explanation of this sentence. Is this intended to be for work going forward once grants are out there, with that contract management, or is this related to bills? This isn't related to bills work. That's the other reimbursement, I believe. I don't know. What is this for?
The answer to your question, Senator, is it is for the pass-through agreements where the Commissioner of Natural Resources receives the appropriation and must, under agreement, place it with an NGO or another unit of government. It's for the preparation and management of those programs.
For which program? For the grants that are going, for which the DNR is the fiscal agent?
Yes.
And so they requested this amount?
I prepared this particular amount and gave it to them.
Okay, well, Mr. that's useful information. As you all know, we're in the process of writing the budget for the DNR for the upcoming year, so this number could certainly potentially be adjusted.
Yes.
And Bill, just to kind of elaborate, the basis for that $175,000?
The basis for the $175,000 is that's what the legislature says.
Thank you. That's also useful information.
Scott? Any further changes? Rick?
I'm going to go back to line 14.
Oh, I'm sorry. We do have an. I'm sorry. Any further discussion on the motion then to insert the in fiscal year 2010 and 2011 on line 10.15 after the word management? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, David. Rick.
We go back to line 14.9 and strike the words "Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council" and insert "Legislative Coordinating Commission."
What line?
Line 14.9.
14.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Bob?
I have a question. This is the language I think that we were told was similar to what is in the LCCMR. Am I correct about that, Mr. Becker?
That's correct.
And does it say in that case that it's the LCCMR, does it say Legislative Board of Commission?
It says Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources.
Representative Hanson's elsewhere. I think
the rationale is we're dealing with much greater scale than anything the LCCMR has done. We have a $40 million project here. I'm concerned about transparency, and I think that if there's a waiver of transparency on large expenditures such as that, it should be elected officials that make that waiver. So that there's direct accountability.
So, Rick, do we have a motion?
Okay,
so we have a motion to strike on line 14.99 the word "Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council" and insert "Legislative Coordinating Commission." Yeah, Ellen.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to speak for or against this, I guess. I just want to say that I can tell you exactly when and where this language was all written. It was at 3 in the morning, the night before the session adjourned, and several of us sat in a room and worked out this compromise language between the House and the Senate and some outside stakeholders who are interested in it. So I guess it's a very sensitive, difficult issue. And I, you know, Representative Hansen, I agree with your intent. But I also think it's never been used by the LCCMR, and the way it's written, I think it would allow this to happen only after the fact. I'm not sure if it will. Maybe we should make. I don't know if this is intended to be before, or if there could be a blanket waiver. We've actually never used this language since we passed it into law, so it hasn't really been. We haven't really figured out how it works, and it might be useful just to think about what do we really mean here. I mean, do we mean that on a project-by-project basis, if a group comes to us and says, you know, we have some land that we want to purchase that's really pristine, and in this particular case, the owner won't participate unless we keep everything confidential and then give us the reason why. If that's the case, you know, I think it's fine to have that the existing language in here. If we're contemplating giving ourselves the authority to just say on every project we're gonna waive this in advance, which I guess this language could allow either interpretation, then I would be really concerned, and I would agree with you that it needs to have some sort of a check and balance on it. So maybe we should be clear about what we intend with this language.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think we probably all agree that we want to have a high level of scrutiny on any activities like this, waiving anything regarding that would impede public transparency. One thought I had would be that if we were to find ourselves in this circumstance, and I frankly don't know that we would or not, I suppose it's just as likely as it's likely not, but there would be nothing that would prevent the council from recommending that this decision be considered and made by, under certain circumstances, by the legislative coordinating commission. Does that make sense? We can review the materials and then make a recommendation that we're not going to rule, so to speak, and that it's of sufficient weight and policy implications that it, in fact, be made by elected officials.
Any further discussion? So, Rick, did you want to amend that motion, or do you, given what Bob just said, or right now the motion is that we delete the words of Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council and insert on line 14.9 Legislative Coordinating Commission.
If I am reading what Bob said right, he would be saying Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council may make recommendations to the LCC on waivers of application.
Yeah, that works.
Another Greg have a actual language of what the effect.
One thing I worry about is I think about the small, really small right. issue kind of stuff that where this authority would apply, but if the added requirement of having the LCC engaged might be a time burden that could impact our ability to actually do what we really want to get done. So I'm trying to weigh those two things out, and I think if the council acknowledges that there's a certain threshold that we're not going to cross,
that would be my
yeah.
Mr. Rager, do you have any thoughts? Oh, I'm sorry. Bill.
Mr. Chair, yes. I guess my question would be to the group, is it anything wrong with leaving it this language this year? I mean, we are a work in progress as we move forward. Is it going to be an issue to try it this way this time? And see how it works. Another comment I'd like to make too before we. I guess we're on the motion, so that
we are on the motion. Question for Greg. So you did make an amendment to your motion. Did you capture that, Bill? And Greg, do you know any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think probably the easiest way to do it would be before Lasard on 14.9, insert Legislative Coordinating Commission, comma, after recommendation by. Then after council, insert comma. So basically, it's after recommendation by the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that would still eliminate any authority for the council for those small circumstances that maybe, frankly, doesn't rise to that threshold. Follow what I'm saying, Greg?
Mr. Chairman, Bob, I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure what that threshold would be before you have to kick it up to the... this just says that if you would recommend to them, and then they would waive the application.
I think the key word here is may. I think we have it. I think we have that flexibility in the word may. We may waive it, we may punt.
Well, you know, Mr. Chairman, another thought, if Senator Anderson was talking about the broad nature of this, you know, the other option we have in 14.11 is the lead project and insert donations so that it only applies to specific donations. That's the issue at hand.
I think that's a different issue.
Yeah.
Okay, so we do have a motion then, and the motion as it stands now, Rick, unless you want to change it, is to delete the words Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council and insert may make recommendation to the LCC to waive.
Well, Chairman, if don't strike anything on the line, it's before Lasard insert Legislative Coordinating Commission, comma, after recommendation by.
That would be your motion. Any further discussion on that motion?
Hey, Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to vote against this, not because I don't understand and appreciate the intent, but I think that we might be doing more homework to try and get to what I think is that balance.
Any other discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not carry. Other changes.
Mr. Chair.
Ellen.
I don't have a change. My staff made a suggestion that I think we should talk about, and that is whether it makes sense to divide this bill into an appropriations bill and a policy bill. And the reason being that, and it's hard to, I'm not sure what the chairs will do, but traditionally, you know, if it's just at the appropriations section, it would go straight to the Finance Committee. I'm not sure. The only real statutory language change is Section 3, which is not a lot of changes at the end of the bill, starting at page 17. But the first policy deadline is this Friday. And so this bill won't even be introduced by then. Most likely, maybe if we were really lucky and really fast, it could be introduced by Friday and sent to the committee. But there's no way it could pass out and meet the policy deadline. So, you know, it's still possible to do it through amendment or by going to the Rules Committee or by putting it into a different policy bill, merging it into a different bill. There's other options for the statutory changes. But I just would think the whole appropriations bill could get kind of stuck if it goes to the policy committee. It might stay on schedule.
Greg?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, it does have the statutory changes basically just effectuate the changes of statutes that be related to the appropriations bill. Mm-hmm. You could have the appropriations without the statutory changes this year. And it's just, I mean, the appropriation language will override the statutory language anyway because it's more specific and it's how you're appropriating the money. That was more or less just to kind of clear it up and to be clean about it. And in talking with the chair and the executive director, Becker, it was thought that this might be, since it is an appropriation issue, that it would... That it might be able to go through without going through a policy committee, but if people don't want to see that in there, you could have the appropriations as they are, and it would still, the statute just wouldn't reflect what kind of the reality is as to how the money, who's going to be administering the council.
Chair, I wonder if Rick has any insight into this, given that his little tiny bill has taken how many weeks and where is it now?
Accounting votes.
Yeah.
Because it's very controversial. And I think when these issues on changing authority hit the legislature, there's going to be challenges with them. So if you don't get called, any committee call, any bill, whether the council wants them to or not. And I think the policy ones will probably get called to the committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, there, I mean, even in the appropriations section, there's a lot of things that could be called policy by somebody who wanted to discuss a lot of the language that's in here. So that's a distinct possibility in a sense as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I guess I appreciate you raising this point. I guess my judgment is this, is that our primary interest is to do the people's will and appropriate, get these funds out on the ground. And if there's anything that we're going to do that's going to jeopardize that over what I see here as council staff, as it is the issue, I think that's a pretty small issue. And I would hate to jeopardize anything that we've done for the last 4 months over something like that. So I think I'm in agreement with you with that. If you're suggesting that we separate this into two bills?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't think that actually the last two pages are going to be the part that we're going to have trouble passing. That's the easy part. That's not, I mean, it does talk about staffing and it makes the correction, but that we intend.
But those are, excuse
but
me.
But it doesn't eliminate the difficulties, the controversies with the bill.
Right, of course. But Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, just to be sure in my own mind, you're suggesting that we would separate Section 3 off as a separate bill, and that would follow a policy path, and the appropriation section would go further. And am I correct in the appropriations bill is less likely to have more stops along the way?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's our hope, that it would go straight to the Finance Committee. But as Rick said, any policy chair who believes it fits within the jurisdiction of their committee could call the bill in. So that's guarantees. Cool. But that would make it a little bit more likely that it wouldn't happen.
Further discussion on this topic. I didn't hear any motion yet. Is there a motion in the offing? What's the will of this council? Before we take this up formally, what's from other members? What's your sense?
No.
Yeah.
If there's no negative to splitting those bills, and if it has a 3% chance of making the appropriations bill smoother, then there's no reason not to do it. If there's no negative to splitting them.
I guess the representative has it.
It makes our job easier.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think
that's and but the likelihood, I mean, let's be honest, I think the likelihood that the House will be more likely than the Senate for this to make a few more stops is certainty, just because it's a bigger body, you've got a few more committees, and frankly, more folks interested in it. So I don't think we should kid ourselves, but 3% is 3%. We spent 15 minutes talking to Mr. Waggy about which should be 1%.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Les?
In a sense, too, if we split the bills, then appropriations is going to be asking questions on policy, and policy is going to be asking questions in appropriations. So I think we have to still, even though we split them, we still have to have them as informative in companion bills as they go through.
Well, I would defer to my legislative colleagues, but my understanding is if we do split these, they will typically follow a much different path through committee structure. That they won't follow in parallel. Is that right, Rick?
But Rick, Mr. Chair, they tend to merge back together wherever the final bill is put together. It would likely, even though the legislative statutory change would go to a policy committee, it would likely be referred to a finance committee, and then it could be merged back in.
Rick,
this gets to a little bit what I think we're going to talk about after the action, but the goal here is to get them to the floor and get things passed, and then we have a conference committee if there are differences. So when a bill passes the body, then it's available for conference. So you have two tracks. I mean, your goal is to get it to the floor and get passed. So it's the route that those bills take that makes it more difficult and more easier. Probably different in the Senate than the House.
Wayne?
Well, it appears that there might be some disadvantages to keeping it together. Are there advantages to keeping it all together? since this is the way we started.
Mr. Chairman, the logic of it, that the appropriations are going to be inconsistent with the underlying statute. And if one passes and the other one doesn't, by keeping it together, eventually it should be put back together, but maybe it's not as far as introduction to get it through, it would make sense. But it would make sense to have the statutory changes along with the appropriations, just so when people reading the statutes, it makes sense and corresponds to the appropriations.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, I would guess that the policy bill is not controversial. It'll pass before the appropriations bill, even though the schedule and timeline is challenging.
Well, we don't have any motion on the table right now. Scott?
I'm going to make a motion to split the bill.
Okay. So your motion is to split the bill after line 17.32. Is there any further discussion on that motion?
No. Mr. Chair, just... one question. I'm just looking through the rest of the bill, and the site visit exception, for example, that's written as rider language, correct? This whole thing is written as rider language from appropriation, I believe. So it's not intended to be statutory change. It would just apply for this year.
That's correct.
So it's sort of in that gray area of appropriation versus policy. But I think it's a good idea to have it. So.
Yeah, my view, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, is that if we found that language worked, next time we put together a bill, we carry it forward and let the legislature consider it.
Rick?
One thing that might be good is some of the boilerplate language just on like ADA accessibility, purpose of recycled material, some of that to include in the second bill of policy, just so you have, this is just more of a... Or do you want that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't recommend that because, like I said, some of it is a little bit gray, but I would hate to have one move forward and the other one not.
You have that.
And then sort of throw those off the bus, so to speak, just because of time, of deadlines. That would concern me. In the LCCMR bill, we have all this language. And just to give you an example, this year in the LCCMR bill, the chair of the policy committee said, well, there's some policy language in there. So I attempted to take that out and put that into a separate bill. But we left all that boilerplate language in the bill, and it has been moving forward through the appropriations committees. And there's the, one sentence policy change that we took out and has yet to receive a hearing in the policy committee. And so... I guess I would say let's go with this, and then if any of the language becomes controversial, that would be a good signal that we should transfer it to the policy bill where it could get more fully vetted by the policy committee.
Yeah, strip it out one.
Rick?
I wasn't proposing either or. I was
sure.
Two-tracking the boilerplate.
Well, I guess I still would prefer not to do that just because then you could end up with two very different looking bills that aren't the same. That makes life really confusing.
So we have a motion to separate the bill into two bills after line 17.32. Is there any further discussion? Wayne?
I have to admit that passing bills is outside of my level of expertise. And I'm just, once again, what is the purpose in layman's language for doing that?
Well,
it lowers the bar.
Mr. Chair, you need to split them?
Yeah.
I mean, we have a policy committee that talks about language, and we have an appropriations committee that talks about the money. And in the legislature, the deadlines for passing bills occur first to the policy committee. So we're butting up against those deadlines really, really soon. And so if we sent the whole bill to a policy committee, not only could it really miss deadlines and prevent it from passing without having to go through some kind of extraordinary measures like going to the rules committee and all kinds of things you don't want to do, that it could also mean that it could get bogged down in sort of rewriting every word that's in here. Whereas the finance committee is trying to look much more at the money and the language that's needed to spend that money correctly. And so it just moves things. And those deadlines are a few weeks away. In the finance case. Did that make sense?
Yeah, you believe that this is the best thing to do, is the better thing to split it?
Yes.
Any further discussion on the motion? Okay, hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Any other changes to the bill as amended? Hearing none, we have a motion on the table by David Hartwell to adopt the appropriations bill and recommend it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And so our plan then is to take a vote or to take testimony?
Yes, I'm sorry. We want to take testimony. Thank you very much. So at this time, since we are done with amendments to the bill, is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on behalf of the bill? Yes, please, Jane.
Thank
Good morning.
You. Good morning. Jane Kronhasker with the Minnesota Land Trust. I just had a couple of minor similar wording issues that I caught with respect to conservation easements in particular. And it was part question, part perhaps clarification. On page 7, in the section referring to the small grant program, one is on line 7.20, where it refers to wildlife habitat plans must conform to the state wildlife action plan. I didn't know what you might mean by wildlife habitat plans. I'm familiar with the wildlife action plan itself, but I didn't know if you meant restoration plans or if you meant wildlife habitat projects.
The answer is projects.
So, Mr. Chair, I think we're hearing a suggestion that on line 7.20, the word plans be changed to projects.
Yes.
And so I make
a we have a motion to change the word plans to projects on line 7.20. Is there any discussion on that? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted.
And then, Mr. Chair, down on 7.23 to 7.25, the same comment that Dave Hartwell made regarding whether public ownership or conservation easement, public conservation easement, should we flip the order of those two references as we had when you were, where that came up in the earlier discussion.
And Mr. Chair, on this point, I'm aware that the Nature Conservancy has contacted me, I think, and Mr. Becker on a similar related issue, so I don't know if it may make sense to hear from them as well as we consider this particular section.
That's fine. This was more the reference to the easement piece. I know there might be some concern about the public ownership. Is there any other kind of conservation
I ownership? I would move that we change on line 7.24, strike public ownership or leave conservation easement and add or public ownership.
Okay, so we have a motion, 7.24, to insert the words or public ownership after the word easement, striking or public ownership at the beginning of that line. Yeah, so someone from the Nature Conservancy would like to comment on that particular change. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Isis Starkin, McGowan Relations Director from the Nature Conservancy. We have concerns as well on that language. Another solution we would suggest would even modify to, quote, on land permanently protected by public ownership or ownership on a nonprofit conservation that meets the requirements of Minnesota Chapters 84C.01 to or a conservation.
So that would be getting at lands that the Nature Conservancy owns in fee title. I guess the question comes back to the permanence of that. But I would defer to other members about.
Well, it says on land permanently protected by conservation easement or public ownership or public ownership or conservation easement. So we've talked about the permanence there. Temporary easements would not apply.
Right. I think we covered it before we had now. I don't have the language in front of me.
I think by breaking out and putting public ownership after conservation easement, it makes it clear that it's conservation easement held by anybody or public ownership as one of the two criteria.
So now we agree with that?
Mr. Chairman Bob, yes, but I thought there was also the issue of when they actually own fee title. The Nature Conservancy owns fee title of the property. Is that an issue too?
I think it could be an issue as well.
And Greg, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how you permanently protect that land if you're letting a private organization, they'd have to somehow promise to never sell it or something of that state, and I'm not sure how that would work.
Sell and sell the conservation easement.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, and you could apply that to, let's say, a local rock and gun club that has 40 acres, and, you know, do we want to do work on that land where that could be sold off 5 years after the habitat work is completed?
Except we've required any transfers to be approved by this body or its successor, so it's going to be tough.
Only if they're acquired now with this money.
Only acquired lands.
Okay. Sorry.
Jane, I guess I'll go back to you. You had some other comments. Or with that, was that the...
No, these are also a couple of clarifications as to whether provisions... Sometimes the language isn't completely consistent when the word acquisition is used, whether it means acquisition in fee or acquisition of an easement. So, for example, on page 11, line 11.6, which refers to the timing for which money is available for acquisitions, and it says acquisition of real property, was that intended to mean acquisition in fee or other interest in real property?
Acquisition was intended to, and property was intended to mean both.
So I would suggest that we use that language that we use otherwise in the statute that refers to acquisition of real property, then add in fee title or other interest. And Greg, you might have the language better when it's in those other project requirements.
I believe the language that we normally use is acquisition of interests.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, Greg,
just for acquisition of an interest in real property, I think we
can
take care of it.
Make that motion.
The motion to insert the words for acquisition of and then insert any interest in real property in line 11.16. Any discussion on that motion?
I think you have to vote on my motion first.
Well, we reversed the order.
I'm sorry. Boy, that's twice now. I'm sorry. Yes.
You like me so. Right.
Losing. All right. So we are back to line 7.24, correct?
Yeah.
All right. Any further discussion on that motion? I thought we had eight here. Hearing none.
Could I have the motion again? Bill?
The motion is to strike public ownership or and insert after easement for the period for public ownership, so that line 7.23 and 7.24 read, must be on land permanently protected by conservation easement or public ownership.
Any further discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No? The motion is adopted. Sorry, so that is adopted. Now going to where we were.
Chair, I'll renew my motion on line 11.
We have a motion then to, Bill, do you want to read back that motion on 11.6?
Insert after the four wheel and interest in.
Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Can we get a little more, I'm lost by what you were talking about with referring to statute such and such. I don't get the issue.
Okay. I think that might have addressed it.
Oh, good. Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, this is a little bit off the subject of our witnesses here, but since I've got page 11, I don't want to forget this. Back before, I think we had the bill in front of us, there were some issues raised, and I don't know if they were just jotted down as notes or ever included. And the one I'm referring to is the cash advance, where I wanted to be clear this was only for 2010. Did we include that, or do we need to vote on that?
We need to make a motion.
Yes.
Okay, so I would like to do that now. We could just say for
fiscal year 2010 only or something like that.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I think if you did on 11.16, 11.17, if you delete the budget period involved and insert fiscal year 2010.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a clarification. So the addition of the first phrase will not make it that motion.
No, I'm just moving. It's fine to just strike the budget year period involved and insert fiscal year 2010. That works.
Okay. Everyone's clear on that motion. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. Back to, this is supposedly a public comment time. So
last piece, I believe, the clarification on page 13, line 13.19, I believe this is under the project requirements. It notes for new lands acquired and then refers to requirement for a management or restoration plan. I assumed this place was lands acquired in fee requiring a restoration or management plan, and I just wanted to clarify that.
Why, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Ellen.
And Jake, why wouldn't it include easements?
It might. All of our easements require a management plan if there's going to be restoration or enhancement, but not all of our lands require restoration or enhancement. So it could be that a simple management plan is nothing is required at this point. But I just wanted to clarify that so that we're consistent with what was intended. Similarly, because our easements are perpetual, management might not take place truly if they decide to do something in the future. There becomes a problem with what is that sufficient funding issue. So if we have a status quo situation that's adequate for protecting the resource, but in the future, 10, 20 years down the line, additional management or enhancement might be desired, we weren't quite sure how we would address the sufficient funding.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Bob.
Gene, what I think I heard you say is that sometimes the plan is to do nothing.
Exactly.
And that is a legitimate
plan. That's a plan.
Yeah. So I wonder if that's necessary.
It probably isn't. I just wanted to be clear because we are one of the few organizations that will be acquiring easements. I just didn't want there to be any confusion going forward as to what our requirements are.
We had the same concerns about that subject, not having necessarily those funds to do the work many, many years down the line or right up front, which it seems to be why it's needed.
Isn't the real issue here I mean, you're talking about restoration is something that is done as you acquire the property. You don't plan to do restoration 100 years. You plan to do restoration at the time you acquire it. So I'm a little lost as to the concern when it's specifically referring to restoration and management plan. If you have a management plan that says do nothing, and there's no restoration in that, where's the need for the funding in the long term?
No. Correct me if I'm wrong, Isis, but I think the problem comes in the reference back to Clause 3,
yep,
where on line 13.12 begins identify long-term maintenance and management needs of the restoration and how the maintenance and management and enhancement will be financed. And if the language on line 13.21, 13.22 applies to that, it implies that they would have to have sufficient funding for the long-term management and that sort of thing. I've always read it as clearly distinct, two different funding packages. One's a first one in Clause 3 is a plan on how the maintenance enhancement would be financed. And so the money is needed in hand in the second clause.
Mr. Chairman, Craig, wouldn't it be better than if you just answer including because this is really the parking plan. You're preparing a restoration and management plan, and it says including. It seems like that should be just part of the plan. And I think if you just inserted after including identification, then that would, I think, address what Mr. Becker was talking about. It would be clear that it's
So just be the line numbers, Greg?
Mr. Chairman, it would be 13.21 after including insert identification of.
We would need a motion to that effect for someone. So what Greg is suggesting is line 13.21 at the end of that line, inserting the two words identification of.
So moved.
All right, we have a motion then to insert those two words on lines 13.21. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Any other comments?
Finally, throughout there's a reference to permanent easements and sometimes to perpetual easements. And I'm assuming you mean the same thing when you use both of those terms. And again, just for clarification.
You mean the same. Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
we should our statute should be consistent, so I think we should pick one and change all the references to that word. I don't care which one.
Mr. Chair, to the committee, we tend to refer to perpetual conservation easements because it's the perpetual nature, not having an end date, that gets it over other statutory requirements regarding re-recording and the need to redo the easement. So we prefer perpetual. Permanent protection through perpetual easements would be the phraseology we would use. So that would be our preference, would be to use the term perpetual.
I would move that we change permanent to perpetual wherever it appears, referring to conservation easements.
Greg?
Mr. Chairman, generally the statutory term we do use is permanent. I think Bowser and other entities tend to use, but if you look at our statutory references to easements, we usually use the word permanent rather than perpetual. So it would be, if you use the word perpetual, it would be different from what we normally use in statute.
I just want it consistent.
So
permanent is fine with me. I don't want to get in conflict with legislators over.
So the motion is to change reference of anything saying perpetual to permanent conservation easements throughout the bill. Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you very much. Yes. Yes.
Section 2, subsection 10, line 13.36, references state certified or state reviewed appraisal. And we think, given the time frame of acquisitions and the likelihood of bottlenecks at the state reviewing appraisals, that it might make sense to use the LCCMR model in when the acquiring entity gets an appraisal that meets the state guidelines and proceeds to acquire the land or interest in land without state review of the appraisal, but submits the appraisal as part of the final accounting of the project.
I can confer with her opinion. I mean, we can submit a state appraisal that was done to Yellow Book standards, and I was involved in one property acquisition where the appraisal review took 11 months. Okay, the project was done. It couldn't move forward until the appraisal was reviewed. It took 11 months. So that bottleneck has a good chance of existing.
We would need some language in our motion, then, if that's the desire of this body. Greg?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I was wondering what other issue I have to deal with. What's the...
So the issue is...
Chairman, I think what you're trying to do is
We do have, I mean, appraisers are certified, and so you basically want to get a certified appraisal, not necessarily one from the Department of Natural Resources. And I think you could, where is the language in the...
Bottom of page 13, 13.36, and top of page 14.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if you just delete it, state reviewed and insert, or just delete or, well, it does say or state reviewed appraisal, so I don't know. I think you can use state certified appraisal under this language. It doesn't have to be a state reviewed appraisal. Because it does, because of the word or in there, I think you're actually okay. The amount paid to the seller and the state certified or state reviewed appraisal. I think since the term "or" is in there, I don't think there's a problem here.
And I just wanted to add along those lines, this is the LCC in our language, and there is another document that refers to land acquisitions, which is in the agreement. It is known as Appendix F, and it delineates what non-governmental organizations must do to acquire land. And I think that actually controls the steps you have to go through in acquiring property.
Any other comments? Is there anyone else who would like to provide testimony before we vote on this bill?
We have two bills.
We have two bills. That's correct. All right. So this is the one part of 97A that requires a majority of at least 9 members to forward any recommendations on to the legislature. So we will need Bill to take roll call. Yes, Wayne?
Mr. Chair, I just had a question about 13.7. When you go through that thing, it explains all the, basically, the components of a plan, and I keep wondering, when the more things you put into what a plan might be, you may either have more that's required or less than is required. And I was just wondering if we should think about, when I look at a plan, I just say all the aspects and don't try to get into wording which one of those aspects are. So I was just looking at this thing. The plan shall include the proposed timetable for implementation for all aspects of the approved management plan. I always get concerned when you get specific about all the different things that are in here that you may have missed something or...
Is that a motion?
Yes.
So could you, you're going to have to get Bill to crack that. Bill, we're on page 13.
Basically what it says is we got 13.7 goes down to 13.14. It lists all the different things in there, using diverse plans, including site preparation, maintenance, and so on and so forth. Excluding the whole works and putting in under 13.7, the plan shall include the proposed timetable for implementation for all aspects of the approved plan.
So, Wayne, just so that I'm clear, that would then, you're suggesting you would delete?
We would be striking everything in 13.9 down to 13.15. Now, I don't know if that's what's in the other, if that's what's in the LCC Mark plan or whatever. I just, like I said, when you start getting specific, did we miss something that may come along?
And Mr.
Not
Chair,
in here doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, Bob, Mr. Chair, I wonder if I think that I think it'll give some comfort way to legislative committees to see. Have some specificity on this. And I wonder if it may be an alternative is to say the plan shall include but is not limited to the proposed timeline, so forth and so on. So it would, they would be able to have these things and anything else that comes up.
That would work. Something just so that right. It goes beyond the things we've talked about here because yeah. There might be other things that aren't listed.
So are you agreeable to that?
Yes.
Suggested language? Bill, do you want to restate that then?
I think the phrase best goes on line 13.9, including the comma, about limited to, and then follows the best.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Okay. We do now have two bills before us, and I'd like to take up first the appropriations bills, which includes Section 1 and Section 2. Any further discussion? If you're none, Bill, you take the roll call, please.
Senator Anderson?
Aye.
Councilor Zinch?
Aye.
Councilor Cox?
Aye.
Councilor Ingers?
Aye.
Representative Gunther?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Councilor Hartwell?
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Aye.
Councilor Nelson?
Aye.
Councilor Rawl?
Yes.
Councilor Schroeder?
Aye.
The chair?
Yes.
11-1.
Okay. We have a second bill now that starts on page 17, the bottom of page 17. Section 3 is now a separate policy bill. Yes, we do. We need a motion now on the second bill.
So moved.
Okay, we have a motion then to adopt and recommend being forwarded to the House and the Senate Section 3 of this new bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Sections 3 and 4.
Sections 3 and 4. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Any further discussion on that motion? No further discussion? Hearing none. Bill, would you take the roll call on that?
Senator Anderson.
Aye.
Councilor Bench.
Aye.
Councilor Cox.
Aye.
Councilor Ingram.
Aye.
Representative Gunther.
Aye.
Representative Hansen.
No.
Councilor Hartwell.
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Councilor Nelson.
Aye.
Councilor Rawl.
Yes.
Councilor Schroeder.
Aye.
The chair?
Yes.
It's 11-1.
Very good. Motion has been adopted. So, members, we have fulfilled our first official responsibility, which is meeting the deadline and exceeding it by about a week or so of recommendations to the legislature on our fiscal 10 appropriations. I think we did great work. We had tremendous time pressures. We had great cooperation from partners, and I'm very appreciative of that, as well as all the members were. I want to just, before we adjourn, I know council members have asked me about what's the next step, and I guess I would refer to members and largely, but including legislative members, about what happens from here, and I would leave this as an open discussion. So with that, Rick.
Just maybe to talk about process and what happens with bill introductions. So the bills get jacketed. It'll take probably a day or two for that to get jacketed. Right now, the legislature is meeting. I think we're meeting three times this week. I'm not sure what the Senate is meeting. But as the deadline approaches on Friday, you'll have a series of short sessions with on the floor, and you'll have longer committee sessions. So a bill gets put into the hopper, and I'll just use as an example, if we had session today and tomorrow, if session tomorrow in the House started at noon, a bill would have to be put in the hopper today by noon. So if you miss that deadline, then you've got another day before it gets introduced. It's put in the hopper, it gets assigned a number, and then it gets referred to committee, and this gets to be where any committee can take action on that. That bill. So it could be heard in a committee, passed out of committee, and then if it's moved to another committee, unless it's within finance and house, it needs to go through the floor with a motion. So let's say it passes the policy committee and gets moved to the finance committee. There has to be a floor session to move that bill from one committee to the other. So that's where time, where days start to move by here, where you can't, you have to have those floor sessions to move things. So it hops between the committees and gets to the floor. In the House, everything will likely end up in Mary Murphy's committee. So she has the Clean Water Funds, the Parks and Trails Funds, and the Arts and Cultural History Fund, and this fund. And contrary to popular opinion, there have been bill introductions, there's been testimony that have been going on for weeks on clean water, parks and trails, and arts and cultural history. So bills are being referred to
to Mary Murphy's committee from the finance committees, and some assembly will probably start on those now that we have a budget target that was introduced in the House last week. So committees know what their appropriation is. They have to do other appropriations beyond what's in these funds, but bills are being heard, and you will hear during this week bills, committees going into the night hearing bills on various topics. Eventually, it'll get through the committee, both various committees, and get to the floor. There will likely be amendments on the floor. I just guess there will be amendments on the floor, regardless of what happens in the committees. And then there will be a vote on the floor. And that will be the House position. And so the House position is what all the members on the conference committee, if it's different than the Senate's position, they follow that House position. The House position may be, or the Senate position may be different than what was just voted on. And those at the conference committee, and the conference committee would have to resolve it and then bring it back to each floor, and then it's voted up or down. And then it goes to the governor for signature. The governor can sign, or the governor could do line item vetoes on it as well when there's appropriation.
Sure, I'll
please.
Let me add to that, because I think that's a good idea, just to talk about the process a little bit. Rick mentioned that the bill will be jacketed, and that means an identical version of the bill will be delivered to the House and Senate authors. So we'll be introducing the bill as drafted and approved. And then in the Senate, I'm hoping that the appropriations bill will go right to the Finance Committee, and then it'll be referred. We have a full finance committee, and then there's divisions of that, and I chair the division that this would be sent to. So the first stop would be in my committee, and then I would refer this bill to the subcommittee chaired by Senator Saxhog, and he would have the hearings on the bill, and then it would go to my full division. And I want to point out that at any committee hearing, members of the public are invited to attend and to ask to testify and speak on in support or against anything that happened, you know, amendments that are proposed perhaps, or at least in general, on the bill. And I'm sure Bill or someone will, and through my office and through the House committee office's staff, we can keep you informed about when those hearings are scheduled. So members are very welcome to attend. And of course, other members of the public are free to attend and express their opinions as well as time permits. I should mention that in my division, this is just sort of an aside, but just to tell you that in terms of scheduling, I have to pass three budgets out of my committee this year, which is a little unusual. And in the House, those are in three different committees. And so I've been kind of burning the candle at both ends this session because I have to pass the federal stimulus appropriations bill for all the energy programs, and I intended to do that first, and I also have to put together the legacy dollars for the water, the parks, and habitat into one bill to leave my division, and then I have to do the regular budget for the natural resources and energy programs of the state. So I've been trying to manage those three different budget bills, and the order that I intended to pass them in was first the stimulus bill, because we're trying to get that passed quickly and get that money out and put people to work as quickly as possible, and the money is now available already. And then in terms of the regular budget, that deadline to pass out of my committee is April 16th. And so I was sort of using April 1st as my rough timeline to start putting together the legacy bill. And so I can't say for sure whether we'll get this bill put together with the water and parks money in my committee before or after the April 16th full budget bill. It could be before then, but we also have the Easter Passover break right before then, and legislators will be gone for about 5-6 days. So it may be after the 16th that we put that together in my committee. So what's going to happen is after we out of the three subcommittees on parks, water, and habitat, those will pass out three separate bills, and then we'll be assembling them into one sort of outdoors legacy funds bill in my committee. And then, and that's the timeline that I'm talking about, that when that will happen. And then after that is done, we will pass that bill to the full Finance Committee, chaired by Senator Cohen. And at that time, my assumption is that the arts funding will be added into that bill. So we'll have one big outdoors and cultural legacy bill with constitutional dollars assembled in the full Finance Committee. And we don't have a separate committee that oversees that. So that's coming from some other committee. So hopefully it'll just go through my committee and its subcommittees and then to the full Finance Committee and sometime in April. And then to the Senate floor, as Rick said. And I agree with Rick that it's likely that there would be amendments offered on the Senate floor to this bill. I'm trying to figure out what those might look like. And then go to the Conference Committee. And the Conference Committee would probably... It can either be three or five from each side, and certainly the four members of the council are likely to be on it, but of course there's other legislators that are involved in the water, the parks, and the arts fund decision-making that would want to be on that council. So there'll be representation from there'll probably be five legislators on each side, a bipartisan mix, most likely.
Just a question of clarification in response to what Rick said. It has to go to the floor when it moves from committee to committee.
That's just for processing. Reported to the floor and then right. Reported back to the committee.
Does that also apply to going from one of your subcommittees to your...
No.
So go from Senator Saxog's committee directly
right to
the
mm-hmm.
Okay. Rick?
And in the House of the Finance Committees, let's say it went from Representative Wagenius's committee to Mary Murphy's committee, then that can be by memo rather than going to the floor. It's going between the policy committee. Now, with what we've done by splitting two bills, the policy will likely go to Representative Pawlowski's committee, and because that'll be an issue relating to the council. That means now the appropriations bill does not have to go to Representative Pawlowski's committee, but it may have to go to Representative Kahn's committee if she wants it. It may have to go to... But once it goes to the finance, it can be moved around. I think where we need help is from council members are on specific, when we deal with the conservation partners, Scott, we need you to be there to be able to testify. Each of the presenters or the entities seeking money should probably be available for questions from the members on any topic. Because we'll walk through the bill, you'll go through each line item, and legislators will have questions like this. So the entities who are requesting should be available to answer any questions. The committees do a pretty good job of keeping jurisdiction. So if you have questions on certain things, they'll probably get answered as hopefully in one committee and not in multiple committees, so you don't have to keep going back and answering the same question. But I think it's important for council members to be there. I think it was very important when we had the Finance Committee that the whole council was standing behind me when I did House File 18. I think that was important in getting that passed. I wouldn't say we need that at every committee, but I think it's important to do that. To have people with areas of expertise be there when there are questions that come up on either the administrative side, the project side, or the process side.
Just on that point, Rick, and maybe a question for Bill, Janelle, or Greg. Are we running up against the open meeting law? If, for example, there's a hearing in Senator Anderson's committee on the bill, and nine members show up.
Mr. Chair, not unless we start to exert our authority, whatever that may be.
In those committees, none.
I think if we're standing in the audience and we may be receiving a little information, that would be the only thing that appears. But it's all a process.
I just wanted to be clear, because obviously we're held to a pretty high standard for open meeting laws. I want to make sure we're all aware of what is advisable and what isn't.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Bob.
A couple of thoughts. I think we already broke that rule last week, maybe when we were at that hearing. So that's an issue. If there was a rule, we broke it. I had a handful of thoughts. One is that I think it's important for us as a council to understand your role, Mr. Chair, and the authors, the bill authors. I have complete confidence that there'll be members of the legislature who will approve this bill. some things that we haven't thought of or things that are far forward that, you know, make a lot of sense that will make things better. And I think that that's obviously always a good thing. There'll be members of the legislature who may, we may not agree with. But we can't always meet as a council, you know, and take a vote on whatever the amendment is. And I think that I'm certainly comfortable with delegating to you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Anderson and Representative Hansen as our chief advocates for the bill. I mean, we've all read and seen Representative Anderson voted no today and last week, but I believe and complete confidence that he is going to be a chief advocate for this bill, as is Senator Anderson. And so there'll be some negotiating that will have to take place, and you're not going to be able to have the benefit of the thinking of all the council members to. And so I certainly understand, appreciate, and respect that you, Mr. Chair, will have to help make some judgments as to whether or not there are amendments that make sense and ones that maybe don't. So I understand that. I think also Mr. Becker can serve to, in a handful of ways. One would be just to inform the council members of when those hearings are. We can all sign up to get notices online immediately in your BlackBerry or whatever device it is when the hearings take place so that you'll know as soon as possible and can adjust your schedules, especially for the folks from Greater Minnesota. That may be a challenge. I think that when the presentations are made, Senator Anderson, Representative Hansen, I have done this a couple of times in my life. I think that I know that there's a script that is followed. You know, it's a short presentation, and whatever thoughts or advice you have on that, but I think every member of those committees appreciate having short, succinct statements or handouts that describe what it is that's going on. And so I know we've got some stuff. Colorful, yes, that's good. Not volumes.
Not expensive
and not volumes either. But so Mr. Becker may be able to serve in that role to summarize what the council has done that could add value to the presentations that you will have to make to those respective committees along the way. So I think those are some of my thoughts. But I think the other thing, too, for council members is to talk to your own legislators and everyone that you know as soon as you possibly can.
I really have two questions for Rick. It looks like Kowalski's committee is certainty. Got to go there. Are there any other policy committees that are likely to call in?
The only one, other one that I think can look at, I mean, actually two, could go to environment policy and it could get referred to game, fish, and forestry, but that would take time. And I'm not sure if those two committees are that interested in it. There's a lot of overlapping membership with those two committees on a couple of the finance committees. So some of those members, if that did happen, they'd be hearing it three times. So I'm not sure if there's going to be that much. I would have to talk with Representative Dale and Deacon, but they have not indicated to me at this time that there's a desire.
The second question is really one of sort of more strategy. What kind of a role do you see councilmen potentially playing prior to the committee meeting? I mean, other than showing up at the committee, my own instincts are you go around and you knock on doors and you try to sell a package to folks who are going to be on certainly the critical committees and maybe others. What's your sense? Is that we're busy people, and if we can be of help, that would be nice to know. If we think we might not be of help in that somewhat different role than just showing up at the meeting. What's your sense?
I think it's important to contact committee members beforehand to be there. I think it's kind of a timing thing, but right now you're going to have a lot of activity because people are dealing with bonding, the budget, and this. So you don't want to be so persistent that it's, oh, you're here again. You want to use your time effectively and make the point, and that's probably as you get closer to the actual hearing, not right before, but a little bit before. I think just kind of combine that with what Bob said. if we look at the finance committee, when we had a little small amendment there, I looked up at Mike, you know, that because there's amendments on the fly that are technical that people are going to make, and we've got to have that ability. And I think as that happens, as we move into more formality stuff, I may just have Mike come down, or Jim, if Mike can't make it, and say, what do you think? Because it's just going to happen. And that provides some help. I think for moving through the House with Darby and David having been the Speaker's appointees, it's good for you guys to be there, and then the Senate appointees and the Senate side as well, just to maybe talk on things. And everybody has their different areas of expertise that they can bring to testimony.
Just a point. Oh, Les, I'm sorry. Did you
hear that?
I was just going to say, in terms of process as chair, what I will be doing is working with Bill and Greg and Janelle to get the bill drafted, and finalized, and jacketed. And then I will put together a transmittal letter that will go to the leadership in the House, the Senate, and the governor, just to let them know here's the bill that satisfies the requirements of 97A. So that's the formal transmission then. In meeting with the leadership in the Senate and the House last week, then they would assign the bill to their author. And that will hopefully, that letter will go out sometime, just from a timeline, later this week, maybe Thursday or Friday this week, if we get all the changes completed and the jacketing of the bill done in the next few days. So, just as a point of information. Les?
Just a little different perspective. I had the opportunity to go up to Ada, Minnesota this week, and it was the Minnesota Soil and Water Conservation District. We had about 60 people attend, 17 counties, all the way from our northernmost county, northernwestern Kitson County, all the way down to Traverse and Polk. And these people are extremely enthusiastic about the potentials that they're seeing. They're very knowledgeable about what's happening in the council. They're very knowledgeable what's happening in the legislature. Their main number one concern is the council's recommendations being passed forward without major disruption. This is the overwhelming comment that we receive time and time again from the people up there. There's going to be a letter writing, a postcard type campaign that's going out to the state of Minnesota. We're going to be putting out almost a million letters to the state and with the recommendation to contact the legislators. A couple of questions I've got. On the advisory council to the conservation grants program, is this something that we should do in preparation to the and preparatory to the bill or after the bill is approved as far as selecting that council? That'd be one of the questions for the council. And the bonding money that you mentioned, Rick, is potential for the RIM funding. If the bonding money is approved, do we keep the funding to the RIM at the same as the council recommended or make some modifications to that? Because I know there's another bill coming through also on it.
With regard to the Conservation Partners Advisory Committee, I would recommend we wait until we get, because we have a number of four that could change to five to three, it could be eliminated altogether. That would be my recommendation, Les.
The Western Minnesota, some of the projects, you know, this is looking a little bit further ahead, but the Red River project that everybody's well aware of right now, from Traverse County all the way to the Canadian border, I think we could have a very significant impact on some of the monies that we spend in those areas as far as buffering areas to that massive flood water that's happening in that area right now and create a tremendous conservation effort. Just one other thing, I'll mention it right now. I think after the session is over and we have a successful completion of the bill, I'm optimistic. I think that it'll flow. I think it's time to get the show on the road. And I would make a recommendation and volunteer to hold that first council meeting outstate, possibly in the Fergus Falls area. It's just a recommendation at this time. We've got the Prairie Wetlands Learning Center that's capable of doing that, probably the June time frame. Review some projects up there. And if the council is willing and ready to go and see what's happening outstate, let's think about that.
Thanks for that offer, Les. In fact, that was one of the last points I wanted to make, was the next meeting of this council. Because we have legislative adjournment at the end of May, more later, hopefully. Question is, we have a lot of work ahead of us thinking ahead. Just over 8 months, and we have to have our second set of recommendations to the legislature for the fiscal 11 Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations. So we've talked as a council initially and sporadically through the review process of developing that strategic plan, that plan about strategically allocating the money in terms of protection, enhancement, restoration activities. We can't wait to get moving on that too long. I am cognizant of the fact that we've gone through a marathon right now getting to the point we are, but I guess I would like to not wait until the end of session to begin that discussion. If that's, if you as council members are okay with that, I guess it would really be to the legislative members, your schedules get, we talked at one time about Fridays, if that would work, and at least initially in January, February, March, it didn't. Are Fridays still for legislators the best days of the week to schedule a meeting like this, or all bets off when you get to the end? Help me out.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, yeah, Fridays are the best day, not this week. I mean, we're going to have committee probably all day Friday because it's a deadline day, so there's exceptions. And for people like Bob who have to travel home, it's not such a great day. But for those of us, the rest, I mean, I'm pretty much scheduled from 8 in the morning till 8 or 9 or 10 at night every day, Monday through Thursday, with meetings like this that I need to be at. So Friday is the only day where there's not normally scheduled committees. That may change. We may have sessions scheduled as we get later on.
What I'll do is I'll ask Bill to put together some sort of a calendar and use the web-based interface to do some scheduling to see what days we can meet. I would like to meet in April at least once to begin. I mean, initially I want to bring back people like Tom Landwehr and Ryan Heiniger and Susan Schmidt, who coordinated those collaboratives, to get a sense from them, some reflection on what worked, what didn't work. Also, just public comments from people who were part of this process about, as we move forward, what to do, what not to do. And that's one of the first things I want to do personally, is to kind of reflect on where we've from where we've come and how to change it as we move forward. Rick?
In April, there is a time window where bills have moved from committee and then you're kind of waiting to take them up on the floor. So you can thread the needle there and get something scheduled where there's some time.
Great.
And then just to follow up with Les, I would not want to do any change because of the bonding bill, because then you fall into the trap of having to have something for substitution. So we just don't want to, part of what I'll be doing this week is trying to hopefully get that, some WRP dollars in, because we have the capacity to take more, more money on the table to get that into the bonding bill and hopefully get that passed.
Bob?
Mr. Chair, on the issue of the scheduling, I agree with you. I think we certainly shouldn't wait. I think sooner than later is best. And, in addition to hearing, do kind of a post-mortem on how the process worked, I think we should quickly then begin to work towards what we're going to do next and how we're going to go about it strategy-wise. I know David has some thoughts on ecotypes and other considerations that we ought to put in place. And when we finish this part, I'd like to come back quickly to this, to the issue of the transmittal letter and have a brief discussion with the council on that.
Ellen and then Darby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on the other thing that Les was talking about, which was big letter writing campaign in support of the bill. And I just want to advise people that when you're communicating with legislators, it's important to be positive, and that, I would recommend that if you're talking to outside groups, to remind them that, political threats and other things like that are not good lobbying techniques. They just make legislators vote against everything you want. So I just something to keep in mind. Just try to be positive and sell it on its merits and let people know why it's important. I think that could be very effective political strategy. Thank you.
I just need some clarification. I'm hearing that the deadline, Friday, is the committee deadline. And does that mean if we don't have something lined up in the policy committee for Friday, we're out of luck? Or just...
Well, Mr. Chair, Darby, the first policy deadline is Friday, and so we'll be lucky if we get the policy bill referred to a policy committee by Friday. And that means it has to pass out of either the House or Senate all policy-related committees by this Friday. So we're obviously not going to make that. it's just not physically possible. Well, I suppose it's conceivably possible if it only had to go to one policy committee and that chair was meeting on Friday and was really wanted to help us. It's possible. But I suspect in the Senate, you know, it could easily have to go to two policy committees. I said one on state and local government and one on environment. So what that means is that, I mean, hopefully if the appropriation bill doesn't go to policy committee, then we won't have that problem there. But the policy piece, there's various ways we can deal with that. One is we can send the bill to the rules committee and say, you know, by law, the legislature set this process up. We didn't have any control over missing these deadlines. So, you know, the rules committee can vote to allow us to go to waive the deadline and go and let the policy committee hear the bill late. The other option is to try to amend this language onto a different bill. But it would need to be done with the, you know, the policy committee chairs. If they're willing to let that happen, that would make a big difference if they would support doing it as an amendment and sort of let the jurisdiction of their committee be excused for this particular.
You know, theoretically, if we could have the bill in, correct me if I'm wrong, y'all, if we could have a bill in the House submitted Wednesday by noon, then it would be Thursday we're having session, and it would be taken to the policy committee, referred to policy committee then. If it's heard in the House and not the Senate, or vice versa, then you still meet deadline. So as long as it's heard in one of two bodies, so I know Bill's very fast, and I know so is staff. I think it's very possible to have the bill in by Wednesday noon. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, on the policy part of it, I'm assuming you could have that ready later today.
Yeah.
Because that, I would say, put a priority on getting that bill jacketed and out later today, even because there weren't any changes in that. It's a pretty simple bill. You could probably have it ready by tomorrow morning.
Mm-hmm. And that would be introduced Wednesday. And then it would be referred to the committee Wednesday. So, but if there's more than one policy committee that has to hear it, that could be good.
Yeah,
but if there's only one that wanted to hear it, you could possibly get it done this week. That's why they're going to be meeting long hours to try to finish as many all the bills that need to meet deadline.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, on the Senate side, you could introduce it on Wednesday. Senator Shadi does have a meeting on Wednesday. There'll be session on Thursday. Mm-hmm. And I assume Senator Rest will have a long meeting on Friday with all the re-referrals usually that committee does. And it is possible.
It's possible.
Any other further comments? Oh, Les.
A couple of contentious issues that, one of them that you brought up, Rick, is the PILT, and I'm anxious to see the Attorney General's Office recommendations on that, because that could, we could form some solutions to that if we get a positive recommendation, and I don't see why it wouldn't be, including possibly maintenance and in part of that trust fund establishing too. And then I think the future is that we're going to have to look at very closely, and we've got some quite a difference of opinions is the access program associated with perpetual leases. So there's some interesting things that I think we need to come up with some major discussion of right after we get successful approval. And just to our legislators, the pressure's on, and myself personally, we will do everything that we can possibly do to help and assist the legislators in a positive form to get this moving forward. The people are expecting a lot from us.
Thanks, Mike. On the PILT question, we had a legislative audit topic selection subcommittee last Friday, and there were 69 topics, and I had suggested that we do look at PILT, that the legislative audit look at PILT in terms of a program audit. The subcommittee narrowed the topics down to 15. So PILT is one of those 15. The process where that goes now is it goes out to legislators to pick five, and they'll be voting. It's not a binding vote, but they'll be voting within the next 2 weeks. We have a subcommittee topic selection meeting, I think, the Friday after next, that will pick eight topics for the auditor to review. So that choice of PILT as a program audit, to have a third-party evaluation beyond the Attorney General opinion,
is in front of members, all 2001 can pick on choosing that to come into the audit. 201. All 201 can choose on picking that. And so that's one of the areas that's now in play for our program audit.
Scott, and then Bob.
I have one request, basically, and I don't know how difficult it is, but in the past I've gotten some emails with some links on it that actually show a video or a podcast of our bills being debated. And obviously I can't drive to St. Paul as often as they're going to be talked about, but I would love an opportunity, if that's not difficult to do, that each time issues that affect the council are being debated, if I could get that video link sent to me.
Excellent suggestion.
Mr. Chair, sometimes it's just audio, but whatever. It's always recorded at least by audio and often video.
Just as this meeting is. Bob, you had mentioned the transmittal letter.
Yeah, I just thought it would be worthwhile, Mr. Chair, just for a couple minutes to kind of talk about what the content of that is. My view is that the transmittal letter can be more than just a perfunctory one or two sentences, but it has an opportunity, I think, to suggest to the speaker and to the Senate Majority Leader and the governor that other considerations be made for other things that we've come to grips with. And the two things that I think about are related to, number one is PILT, and Representative Hansen discussed that, and I think that we may suggest to the chair include in his transmittal letter that the legislature take a careful look at the issue of PILT and come up with adopt a proposal that could guide the council's decision-making in the future. And that might be worthwhile. And then the second is we've had a number of presentations made by folks who are extraordinarily well-intentioned. Their projects have great merit, but they don't fit the constitutional mission of the council. We've had a couple of folks who have had projects that are more in the park area. I think there might be an argument that some folks had ideas that were of more meritorious for the clean water funds. And when I've talked to those folks offline, as maybe many of you folks have, when I ask the question, well, have you thought about the parks funds? What I get is, well, yeah, but I don't, where's the council for that? And so I suggest that it might be beneficial that the legislature consider identifying an approach for funding from those particular sources. It could be a council, a parks council, for example, might make merit. I don't know. That's one option. You have a clean water council. Perhaps they get anointed as being the body that then provides recommendations to the legislature on how to use the clean water funds. But I think it might be beneficial to the folks, the constituencies that are out there, to have an identified resource that they can use, that they can make presentations to, and that that can benefit the legislature as they consider how to use those funds. So, if there's any other thoughts on that, a different opinion.
Those are good suggestions. I've been writing.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't necessarily share your opinion about the councils, mm-hmm. creating more councils, so I'm not sure that I would want that to be a recommendation in our letter.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, council is one option. There may be others I'm not aware of. But I think the point is this, is when people are in the parks community, see that there is additional funds that are now available, it would be great for them to have an identified source that they can go to. And that also helps the legislature as they sort through all of the range of things that are out there. People who are experts in council might be one option. People who have some experience are experts in this. Can provide guidance and a sorting, if you will, that's beneficial to the legislature. But it's not necessarily the only option.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would just say we're having a lot of discussions about how to make that process as transparent and open to the public as possible. And I'm not sure that this council necessarily needs to wade into that without spending some more time on that discussion with a lot of other interested parties.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, but I don't think I can't imagine that you're opposed to the notion of trying to provide some guidance to the folks who are interested in parks funds.
Okay. No, absolutely.
Or clean water funds, or for the arts funds. Mm-hmm. And so however we can help those communities out, because we've seen them. They've come to us and said, boy, I've got a great idea, and it's a parks-related thing. Third?
Yeah, but certainly what I've been telling people when I ask, you know, to come in with, you know, talk to me about this great project, and it is a nice project, but it doesn't belong with us. And they say, well, then what do I do? What I've been telling people is locate your local legislator. I mean, there's no rule that says anybody can't approach a legislator
sure.
and say, you know, put in a bill. I mean, you got to convince the legislator that it's a good idea, but, I mean, there is a vehicle. That way, the folks, you know, think about their own local representatives.
And Mr. Chair, you know, as I said, we're in the process of trying to set up better procedures, because I get this question probably more than you do even. And people are asking me, and other legislators are asking this all the time, how are we going to set this up? And so there is an ongoing discussion about that, and we're working on setting up a process. And part of it includes, as Darby said, it's the legislative process. And, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that the legislature, obviously has final decision-making authority over this whole fund, the whole constitutional fund, and there may be differences of opinion about, for example, whether parks has to be, if you're in a park, you have to apply through the parks funding. And so, I mean, some of us are trying to look at the big picture and how it all relates together. And so it's a complicated discussion. And we're trying to do the very best job we can of following what the voters' intent was and trying to resolve that. So I'm not sure what else to say, except that we're talking about, for example, setting up a website that would be a portal for the public. And one of the things that I was talking about this with some clean water stakeholders last week, not parks per se. We've had this discussion in other contexts with some parks advocates, but that we need to have one place where people can go to find out if they have a project, what funds it would qualify for, not just constitutional funds even. I mean, on the one hand, we need to have a very clear accountability for all the constitutional funds in one place. And I think that's because when the voters voted on that amendment, they didn't just vote for Habitat or Parks, or they voted for the whole shebang. And so they need to be able to look at one place and see where is all that money going and what are we getting for the money. And then you also, I think, and this is sort of one of those bigger picture issues that goes beyond the constitutional funds, we're hearing as part of this discussion that if people want to fix, you know, do something to improve the water quality in their lake, they don't know which funds exist and how to access them, and if they might have to call 8 different state or local government agencies to find out. And so the discussion of how to use the constitutional funds has triggered a broader discussion about how to enable public participation in doing the work that we all care about, you know, improving our natural resources. And so we're looking at sort of broader solutions to that. We're looking at reorganizing state agencies, for example, as a response to that, so that water programs are more easily accessible and transparent, rather than being in, you know, 8 different government agencies. So that's all I'm trying to say is that I don't want to give you the whole.
Mr. Chair,
it's just an example of the complexity of these questions that, and sort of the picture, if you look at the really big picture, it goes a lot beyond just what the structure should look like for the constitutional funds.
Bob, and then, yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, the bigger issue is really not Habitat, it's not clean water, mm-hmm. it's not parks, mm-hmm. it's not the arts. Though I would say that the arts has the State Arts Board, clean water has a clean water council. We have the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. I'm not really sure what the parks have. Probably something, but I'm not sure what it is. The real big issue is governance. How do we govern? And I think that I think we've seen the benefits, I believe, of this council and its efforts to achieve conservation outcomes, and I'm optimistic that we will be able to convince the legislature that it is in their best interest and their best interest on multiple fronts, and not the least of which is to do the public's will, to have the advice and counsel of others who are maybe not immediately elected officials on advisory recommendation cases. And that model may be of benefit for these other dedicated funds, again, on advisory basis. And so I simply suggest that to the degree we can be helpful to the legislature and suggest that the work that you're doing should reach a conclusion that is provides a map to people and confidence in the outcome, I think is helpful.
Jim, and then Les, and then Wayne.
Yeah, I just have a question for Senator Anderson. I would just be curious on this year's allocations for the clean water and the parks. What open and transparent process and what efforts is the Senate making to get all this information and to have this process that you've endorsed through our process here? What is the Senate doing this year to come up with their appropriations for this year?
Well, Mr. Chair, Jim, I appointed subcommittees, so we have official subcommittees that have been meeting and have had public hearings that are open to the public and provide notice and welcome and encourage people to come in and testify and give their opinions and present proposals for funding. And so we've been going through that just like this group has done. That's what the legislature does routinely, and that's what we've been doing with these subcommittees. We're also looking at we've also had the same sort of short timeline to do this, so we haven't done everything we want to do yet, and we're intending for these subcommittees or other related groups, you know, we may expand them beyond subcommittees, to go out and have public hearings around the state over the next year, just as this council may do, I don't know, and to try to get more public input. We're also trying to put together a state water sustainability plan and a parks plan, and we have legislation to do both of those things. In fact, the water plan, sustainability plan, is up for a hearing tonight in the Environment Policy Committee. I'm the author of that. And that will be a process that will involve University of Minnesota scientists working with stakeholders that are broad-ranging stakeholders, from local government to technical staff in the state agencies to nonprofits to other, you know, community organizations around the state that are interested and have expertise in this area. They'll be working together to put together policy recommendations. So we're trying to put together some... and then we also have these... maybe that's enough. An answer. There's a lot of different pieces involved in this, but that's some of the steps that we're taking.
Have you had a lot of public participation in your process?
Mr. Chair, we've been trying. We opened them up and tried to make them as public and welcome. I mean, they are public, and we've been trying to spread the word, but it's hard to do that during the it's the legislative process, and people who pay attention to that are the people who pay attention to that, and a lot of people don't really pay attention to it, and so that's why we need to go outside the Capitol when the session is over and try to do more outreach. But there's a lot of, you know, there's something called the G16, for example. This is a group that's sort of a self-created coalition of public, private, local government, chamber of commerce, environmental groups, for example, that all worked together over a number of years to put together the Clean Water Legacy Law. They passed that law. I mean, they wrote the recommendations for that law, brought that to the legislature, and have continued to come together as a coalition, a very broad-based coalition, to support adequate funding for implementing the requirements of the Clean Water Legacy Law, which is our long-term plan to clean up the state's surface waters, test, create plans, and restore and protect those surface waters. So that's a broad-ranging coalition that represents a lot of Minnesotans from a lot of different points of view. So we do have the benefit of a lot of organized advocacy, but it doesn't, just like this group, we sort of rely on organizations that have members to bring ideas to us. And getting beyond that is always a challenge for elected officials as well as for any group like this. And we're, I think, you know, putting this website out there and publicizing information is another way to create a lot of access for the public. And so we're trying to figure out the most effective way to do that as well.
Very briefly, after this legislative session and after the funds are allocated, the proof is really going to be in the performance and the scrutiny of public opinion, which we should be under the high scrutiny of public opinion to make sure that we get the job done. So, and if we're missing an area, we're probably going to have to make some changes and increase our efficiency and increase our effort to handle that area. But public scrutiny and the performance after we're done is going to be the measurement.
You know, normally I agree with Bob about 95% of the time, and this time I got to say that, you know, this process is very independent from all the other ones, and I would like to see our transmittal letter go unmuddied, perfectly clear exactly what we're looking for here, and not include anything else. On the other hand, I know what you're talking about is the fact that a lot of people that came to our presentations weren't aware of the next avenue to take, and so I think that should be a supplemental memo explaining to everybody what we did see here and what we have noticed, and tell them and then explain that a lot of people need and a lot of organizations need this avenue in order to be able to do that, to carry their concerns forward.
Any further? I know we're approaching 11 o'clock, and I know that legislative members need to leave. Any further discussion? Remember, we did good. Again, think back, December 1st, we didn't know each other. We now have a bill with some great projects. I think it's, again, putting conservation first so we can all pat ourselves on the back for a great job, but the work has just started now as we move this through the legislative process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, did we agree on the next meeting?
We know bill will be circulating through some either web-based or whatever, some potential dates for the
date. Thank you very much for chairing.
Welcome. Thank you.
I think he is to get the committee hearing scheduled.
Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Any discussion?
Yeah.
If you're none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. I need to talk to him about our schedule because I'm not burning my weekends over the summertime driving up here on Sunday.
Maybe Thursday.
You know, there's chasing dogs. I didn't have a lot of choices early on. We were crunch time, and you got to do it when you can do it. But we're going to meet during the meeting. We're going to start about 10 o'clock in the morning so I can drive up that morning, do my business, and get home without ruining. It ain't going to be Friday either because I can tell you that I'm leaving on about 5 motorcycle trips this summer at noon on Friday. You know, or otherwise I'll just have to miss some. You know, I've not missed one. We've had probably 10 or 11 meetings and I've not missed one. Now they want me to drive up and testify at the Senate. We're going to have to work on that. Schedule around. I don't think I mean, if
Where did your son go to Huntsman's?
Colorado School of Trade in a suburb of Denver. It is supposedly like the
spot. Yeah. When you get a gunsmith certificate or whatever it's called, a degree, then you do what?
You start out, I call it in retail.
Yeah.
You start out working at a Shields or a Vandermonte.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are manufactured guns that break. You know, they bring them in, you fix them. Or people do upgrades, you know, where they'll buy pants and scopes and shit, you know, right. Mount scopes and stuff. Ultimately, a new drug for guns. Ultimately, they work to a point where they start to build custom firearms. That's the epitome of being a gunsmith. There's a guy in Westbrook, Minnesota. His name is Stan Weir. Stan Weir builds two guns a year and makes a fabulous living.
Right.
He gets $35,000 a gun and makes two guns a year. Mostly really high end, like Barnett guns. Something you can shoot a prairie dog at 600 yards with, you know. And, that's the ultimate.
He probably takes orders, you know, 3 years in advance.
He used to be a pretty regular gunsmith, but his son died in a motorcycle accident. I knew the guy well. He just like crawled like a crab crawls in a shop. He didn't even come out of his shop. I don't think. Yeah, that'd be a tragedy.
What's the rest of the year?
My dogs are with me.
Yep.
I brought them along. So when you holler at a dog, if you say here, or if you go choo choo choo, that's here with a whistle. The whistle just cuts the muddle. If you're in a group and everybody's talking, you blow the whistle, and that's just it's just a higher impact request than a voice command. And so when I'm with my boys out running around, I don't holler and call them. It's all yeah. I like that. So.
Mr.
Bench, you have a good one.
Oh, I'm going to be around for a while. You heading back?
Thanks a bunch.
I got my reunion with my old secretary. And Tomorrow is very bad.
Tomorrow, thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you bet. All the rest of us, too. just have to stay the course? Not completely, of course, serious problems. So it makes it a little diffuse, a little bit.
Bob agreed to step in and small grants would be one of the ones that I can come to. And then the other question is that travel need to be approved? Any thanks for that? Because that's not a regular LOAC meeting. And then how do I get my travel approved so that I can come?
I can take the bill.
Thank you again.
Thanks again.
Thanks.
Greg, thank you for all your help.
No, I'm headed home.
Let me turn that off.
Please. If I